27th, 2026. I'm Matthew Leck, in for Emma Vigeland, who would be in for Sam Cedar, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report, broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Emma talked with Shahid Azadi, award-winning freelance writer, former editor at Bustle UK, and former staff writer at Stylist magazine, about her book, The Othered Woman, How White Feminism Harms Muslim Women. Also on the program today, hundreds and hundreds missing in apocalyptic scenes in Nepal as a collapsing glacier causes a landslide, avalanche, tidal wave, flood that swept down a valley. A Navy sailor and also who is also a 19-year-old and a father of a 3-year-old who had jumped overboard on the USS Lincoln in an apparent suicide attempt is to be charged with malingering. Another 19th century headlines.
Measles and malingering.
Yeah. Other military news. A West Point climate professor sues after being fired for teaching climate scientists. More on that, actually, in the first segment here. A moronic trade war with Canada continues. U.S. faces surging toilet paper prices and an alcohol boycott. The Trump mail ballot order advances despite chaos warnings and new legal challenges filed. This while the DHS admits that it, surprise, inflated, get this, inflated non-citizen voter roll numbers. The DHS is lying? The Department of Homeland Security doing lies?
What, from 0 to 11 million?
Man. Post officials warn that the Trump mail ballot plan will cause a 20-30% error rate. Is that bad for election? Maine GOP nominee calls for ICE agents at polling places in unearthed audio. He's got a friend named Tom Homan, he says. The State Department designates pro-Palestinian groups as terrorist organizations following the lead on a group like Palestine Action that was set by the UK Courts of Justice. Zuckerberg's Meta settles with 47 states for $17.1 billion over child social media addiction. A judge sides with Texas, blocking Minnesota's extradition of an ICE agent. An Israel-funded think tank, Israel has funded a think tank to manipulate AI chatbots with pro-Israel propaganda, basically creating a think tank that they could have AI language models use as a source. Student visas dropped 23% in 2025 under Trump immigration crackdown. And finally, a state grand jury found the DeSantis administration misappropriated taxpayer money when it diverted $10 million from a Medicaid settlement into the Hope Florida Foundation in order to fund political activities. All that and more on today's Majority Report. It's another Max Left with Matt Leck. Majority Report. Emma's out at a wedding. Sam will have a pre-tape, I believe, with Digby tomorrow.
That's right.
So look forward to that. And Emma will have the interview today. I do want to do a little bit of a free speech moment here. First, and I didn't print out a sound sheet, so you can help me with the details of this Beverly Hills teacher here. But a Beverly Hills teacher has been fired for... I mean, truth, I think, is that the James Damore Google guy, what he said, like, you know, women can't work here. That was his truth. But I don't mean to mischaracterize that, but I think I got it right. Anyway, here is a Beverly Hills teacher talking about how her speech was suppressed by a administrator.
It was an amazing 30 years, and I enjoyed almost every moment of it.
Joni Garrett spent 30 years in the classroom, 15 of those years at Beverly Hills Unified. In November of 2024, she was at Beverly Hills High School as a substitute teacher, helping students prepare for the AP U.S. History exam. That's when things took a turn.
Certainly one of the most traumatic experiences of my life, because I looked at my home at Beverly Hills Unified School District as my home away from home. And, you know, where I had spent so many, you know, years and had so many wonderful memories. And now I'm persona non grata.
It happened after this pro-Trump rally on campus the day after the 2024 presidential election. Students in MAGA gear cheered and waved Trump signs, but Joni says some took it too far, harassing other students.
This was extremely intimidating to students of color and students who did not agree with them. And several of those students went to Joni Garrett's classroom and they confided in her, some teary-eyed.
The next day, Joni took to her personal Facebook page. She accused those pro-Trump students of harassing their classmates and using racial slurs, blaming President Trump for the behavior. 6 days later, an email from the district.
It said, "Posts which appear to be from your personal account have come to my attention. Please plan to meet with me tomorrow to discuss." Mr. Horvath told her, "Look, we don't want you here anymore." She goes, "Am I fired?" "Yeah, we don't want you coming back."
Now, nearly 2 years later, she's suing the district, arguing it punished her for expressing her political views on her own time and her own Facebook page. Garrett is now seeking unspecified damages and arguing the district violated both state labor law and her First Amendment rights. Her lawsuit even points to the district's own policy, which says an employee's personal political beliefs or activities cannot be grounds for discipline as long as they don't violate the law.
Free speech still exists in the United States of America. Freedom of speech is important, and people should be able to express their opinions without fear of retaliation.
Yeah, so this has long been something that I've maintained is that, I went to public school in North Dakota. It's turned out that a lot of my favorite professors also tend to be the ones that will say, like my Instagram post to this day about Alex Pretty. And they have to, what do the kids say, hide their power levels, because this sort of thing happens. This is really the suppression that goes on in this country. And there's a story here in the New York Times at the U.S. Military Academy. So not just California schools here. West Point climate professor says he was fired for refusing to defy science. Dr. Adam Kalkstein is suing the U.S. Military Academy, where he was a professor of geography and the only climate scientist after being fired. After 17 years of teaching at West Point, Dr. Adam Kalkstein says he was suddenly ordered last year to cut from his curriculum information about the human causes of climate change, according to a new lawsuit filed against the U.S. Military Academy. The change was immoral and potentially illegal, Kalkstein says. He told Brigadier General Shane R. Reeves, who at the time was dean of West Point. Instead of upholding Army values, Dr. Kalkstein said he felt like a liar and a fraud. General Reeves stormed out of the room. I do like that detail. Stormed out of the room when Kalkstein declined a suggestion that he resign, according to a lawsuit. 6 months later, the tenured professor was told his contract would not be renewed. Filed in the Southern District of New York, the lawsuit accuses West Point of breaking the law by violating Dr. Kalkstein's First Amendment rights by forbidding him from teaching about human-driven climate change, an order that required him to omit a massive, fundamental, essential component of the court and to defy science, according to the suit. Spokesman for the Pentagon, West Point, and the White House did not return requests for comment. These details are fascinating to me. Michael Sussman, the lawyer of Kalkstein, said his client is a conservative Republican who believes the military needs to be taught the true causes of climate change when it comes to national security. In a letter to Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, Dr. Kalkstein said, "Understanding the causes of global warming was important not for social justice reasons, but for things like competing with the Russians in the Arctic and knowing why sea ice was melting." He's loyal to the cadets in the academy, Mr. Sussman said about the professor and to his perspective. Edicts that he can't say what's true in a classroom is beyond his tolerance and totally counterproductive. We can't really be honest about why there might be more attention paid to the North Pole, because it's all open sea now because we melted everything. I just think the detail of how both the administrator in this Beverly Hills case and this dean here at West Point, this Trump moment, we all think about it as Trump. But there are all these conservatives in all these institutions that have been waiting for this moment. And they haven't been able to win based on their arguments, because climate change is real and man-made, you idiots. You're never going to win that without a big daddy. And those little deputy like Pete Hegseth coming through. They could have never won those arguments. And likewise, you see across newsrooms that have taken years to call a genocide. Congrats, or not congrats, commendations to New York Magazine editorial board for making their stance clear about that. But the truth is that all these news organizations, they have plenty of people. New York Times has plenty of people that knew that what's going on in Gaza would amount to genocide. They read the same scholars. In fact, sometimes they publish op-eds by people that have the credibility on that. They know that. There are people at the top, though, that want to enforce different understandings of the world, that are more open to domination by the most powerful forces in the entire planet. And they are using this moment everywhere, whether it's at a local school or whether it's in the National Institute of Health or the CDC or any bureaucracy and even any corporation. This is the moment where conservatives get to punch their kid, get to be the kid, the bully at the schoolyard who knows that their dad will step in case anyone punches back. But people do need to start punching back about this stuff. And I hope those lawsuits are successful. We have no ads today, which is a big relief to me.
But I would say regarding the climate change thing, I would direct people to Abby Martin's documentary, Earth's Greatest Enemy. We interviewed her about that she did with Mike Prisner, talking about the U.S. military being the world's largest polluter.
Yes, very good call. And actually, you mentioned Mike Prisner. He is cited in this article. I don't know if you saw it in the packet today about the record number of folks saying, hey, I don't think I want to be in the military anymore. It doesn't seem like it doesn't seem like I'm helping the world. And that's sort of the idea that my teenage ass thought I'd be doing when I signed up for it. And instead, I'm bombing the school in Iran. So there was record numbers. So Pete Hegseth he's touting these record recruit numbers. There's also record numbers of, I'm forgetting the term for it. You would know.
Well, where you don't re-enlist?
Or where you want to conscientiously object.
Oh, conscientiously object.
Yep. Yeah. We can turn the tide back on all this stuff because the truth is, like, they can't win without this sort of stupid force of you're fired because you blamed the president for the hate rally caused by him trying to take over the 2020 election.
Do you know how demoralized this country has to be about the military with the economy this bad, with college this inaccessible?
Like no future.
Yeah, like the complete poverty draft the poverty draft is failing now.
Yeah.
In a time where everything is failing and everybody's suffering.
That's actually even mentioned in the Shane Gillis thing that we'll talk about in the fun half there, where they're like talking about healthcare and they're like, but, you know, like that's how we get people into the military. Yeah. Sick. It's a pretty sick system we have set up. And see, not sustainable to maybe try to appeal to some of the more corporately minded folks out there. But let's now get to this interview with Shaheda Zaidi on The Othered Woman, How White Feminism Harms a Muslim. We'll go to a break briefly first. And then, we'll see you on the other side, folks.
We are back, and we are joined now by Shahed Zaidi, award-winning freelance writer, former editor at Bustle UK, and staff writer at Stylist Magazine, author of The Othered Woman, How White Feminism Harms Muslim Women. Shahed, thanks so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Of course. Can you define white feminism for our audience? Because it's not just about, white women, right? It also intersects with liberal feminism and feminism under capitalism. How do you define it in your book?
Yeah, so white feminism is this concept of a kind of a default womanhood that is concerned with the issues primarily of white, middle-class, heterosexual women, and it focuses on them achieving equality with a specific group of women and achieving equality for them and, opening up the door for themselves and kind of telling other women, if we open up the door for us, we can pull the ladder up later without ever actually pulling up the ladder up later for other women. So, yeah, and it's connected to kind of this idea of, capitalist feminism and carceral feminism and liberal feminism. But I wanted to include the term white in the title because I think it's important to name the problem of kind of the structure of white power and white privilege in Western society, and how that connects to this idea of white womanhood as the default, and how white feminism is concerned with protecting its own power structures, even if it's at the compromise of kind of supporting other marginalized women, either in Western societies or in the global South. So yeah, I thought I really wanted to kind of name that. And, you know, I was looking, reading other books and other kind of journal articles and academic articles who also kind of used white feminism. And I thought it was, yeah, important to kind of, I guess, name the problem that we're dealing with.
And what are the structures that white feminism protects? You mentioned them a little bit there, but I think when analyzing white feminism through a critical lens, it's also about analyzing Western imperialism through a critical lens. And that's super relevant when we're talking about Muslim women being excluded from white feminism.
No, absolutely. It's why in the book there's a chapter on kind of global conflicts, because I think it's important to look at how white feminism isn't just harming kind of on the individual or local level, it's being used at the highest level, at the global level, to either justify or, you know, excuse global conflicts. I use the example of Afghanistan and Iraq wars, that there was an author that called Afghanistan the first feminist war, because there was a lot of feminist organizations in America that kind of propelled how the US government managed to kind of get the US public on side and make Afghanistan and Iraq as well seem, I guess, more moralistic or palatable wars when you concern them with women's rights. And, oh, you know, those women over there, look at how they're dressed, or look at the lives that they're living. We need to go and save them. Whereas actually, no, that isn't the case. You know, Western nations that want to go into other countries aren't always concerned with, you know, human rights or moralistic values. It's more about kind of imperialism and expansion of foreign powers and material extraction. So, yeah, I think it's so important to think about white feminism at that really big global level, because it isn't just about, you know, exclusion at the local level, which is just as important. But also when it comes to kind of, yeah, war and conflict and those really, you know, the macro and the micro.
What then is white feminism's relationship to Muslim women? I think the imperialism piece is important, but we're seeing these arguments deployed even with Iran in the Iran war right now, and the U.S.'s involvement there about saving the people of Iran from the Islamist regime that runs Iran. But, you know, dropping bombs on girls' schools, not necessarily, I would say, a feminist action?
No, and that's exactly it. It's using the rhetoric of white feminism to kind of, you know, go into other nations, or, you know, expand imperialist powers, but without actually, you know, you're saying that you're saving Muslim women, and that's not such a big stereotype for white feminism, is that this idea that Muslim women are seen as so different, and kind of, you know, this idea of them being like the big sister to their little sister, and how, you know, Muslim women are seen as kind of backwards and submissive and kind of inherently unliberated compared to kind of Western women who are seen as, you know, liberated and living lives that we could never live because of our faith. So then, yeah, you've got the example of, you know, Iran, and how that is also kind of playing on that stereotype of like, we need to go in and save these women who need saving from this Islamist regime, without ever thinking about the nuance and context of that. And also the fact that there are Iranian women on the ground who are fighting back against the Islamist regime, and they are fighting back against, so they've been doing it for centuries and decades, but their voices and their agency get taken away from the conversation, because it's just seen as this trope and this idea of, oh, the West needs to save, the global South from this kind of violent religion that is Islam.
It presents the white colonial powers as essentially liberators, as saviors, and that fits really nicely into an effort to sell a public on the goodness of an imperial war, essentially. Like, this is actually quite old when you look at colonial propaganda. Can you talk about how these tropes have been used historically?
Yeah, absolutely. I use the example of Algeria in the 1950s under the French colonial rule, and the French in Algeria as a way to, I guess, enact colonial force onto the Algerian population. They did unveiling ceremonies, and it became a ceremonial act of getting Muslim women onto, you know, either a stage or in public in front of an audience, and kind of, you know, the act of removing the veil became the act of kind of, you know, it became this concept of freedom and liberation. which, you know, was hypocritical to the sense that this was, you know, the French colonial rule was right. saying that we are unveiling your Muslim women. So that becomes an act of freedom. But, you know, no women or men were free under, you know, the French colonial rule. Same in Egypt in the late 1880s when they were under the British colonial rule. And there was a man who was a British consul at the time called Lord Cromer. And he was, you know, famously like really anti-women, misogynistic in the UK. When it came to Egypt, he used this kind of white feminist rhetoric of, oh, well, you know, Islam in Egypt is, you know, demonizing Muslim women. You're not letting them do X, Y, and Z. So he kind of pushed that, you know, propaganda and that rhetoric without actually being supportive of women, because back home he was voting against the suffragette movement. So there's the idea of taking this white feminist rhetoric and making it work for, you know, the colonial powers in force, or, you know, now with imperialist powers, making it work for you to make you look, I guess, like softer or more palatable or more moral. Because I think when it comes to, like, say, you know, quote unquote, saving women and children, like you said, it's a really easy sell to the public.
And it also absolves white men, because it portrays Muslim men as uniquely anti-feminist and violent mm-hmm. in their treatment of women.
Yeah. And that's why I wanted to do a chapter on Muslim men and the stereotypes that exist around them. Because, yeah, the patriarchy that, you know, we all live under a patriarchy, but I guess the patriarchy that exists in Muslim communities is seen as kind of unique or exceptional. And the Muslim men in our communities are seen as inherently violent, you know, predators. And we're seeing it now in Europe with kind of the migrant, quote unquote, migrant crisis, and how the term migrant and Muslim has become quite interchangeable. And so, you know, there's far-right groups in the UK who are calling, you know, the small boats crisis. They're saying that, you know, Islam is being kind of forced onto the country, and they're, you know, using Muslim men as kind of the examples of, oh, they're predators or they're rapists and they're bringing violence to the country. Whereas actually, I would say that the misogyny of Muslim men, because I'm not saying that we don't have it in our communities, we absolutely do, but I don't think it's any different to the misogyny of the other men in other communities. I think sometimes Muslim men use Islamic language, or they, you know, co-opt policy that we in our faith to kind of further their misogyny. But at the heart of it, I think it is still that patriarchal violence and that misogyny that exists in all communities.
Can you then expand a little bit more on some of the stereotypes that you lay out in your chapter on the efforts to paint Muslim male misogyny as unique? Like, what are the tropes that are deployed to further that myth?
So the main one I would say is this trope of the terrorist or the predator. We see that obviously in kind of news and in kind of fictional media. You know, there's plenty of shows that kind of deploy this again and again. So that's the main one. But there is another one where it's this idea of kind of feminizing Muslim men and kind of removing, you know, desexualizing them completely as an effort to dehumanize them further. I think in the Iraq war, they also kind of did the, you know, the US and its Western allies kind of did this, where they kind of feminized men in a way where it was, yeah, completely dehumanizing. So it's kind of two extremes. It's either they were completely ultra violent or they were kind of feminized and dehumanized in that kind of way.
But what do you mean by that? I'm curious.
It's, yeah, I think it's this idea that they're not real men. Mm-hmm. So kind of looking at it from that kind of perspective. So, yeah, this idea of, yeah, so you've got one side, which is like the terrorist, the predator, which is kind of, you know, ultra violent. And then the other side, which is, yeah, they are not seen as kind of, you know, quote unquote, real men. So then they are not treated, I guess, as a person. And so their humanity is kind of taken away. But I think the more common one that we're seeing, I say in the last kind of decade, especially since 9/11, is this idea of the Muslim man as the terrorist and the predator.
Right. The feminizing one is more when it's almost like the orientalizing also meant making them into Muslim men into kind of mystical beings as opposed to just men yeah. like every other man.
Exactly. And it's this idea of they're not just, yeah, I think both stereotypes, what they do is, they don't just kind of just see them as like any other kind of man. They have to be seen as kind of, yeah, like exceptional in either two different ways.
Right. And I will say that, like, when you speak about this, these are also many valid complaints about how Black men are portrayed in our media, yeah. whether it's you have to be kind of providing entertainment. Clownish is not how I would describe it, but like in the most extreme examples. And they're sometimes feminizing there. There have been criticisms of the impulse to for sometimes black men to portray women and how white comedy spaces did that. But also most perniciously, of course, is the violence, the protect your white woman from black men. I mean, this was used all across the country, obviously, most acutely in the Jim Crow South and in the even post Jim Crow South as well. Yeah. White women are under threat from this brown man or this black man.
And I think we're seeing this. I mean, not to say that that trope, you know, we're still seeing that with black men, but I think that kind of framework is now being applied to Muslim men as well.
Palestinians most acutely right now, absolutely.
Yeah.
Including in, you know, reporting about sexual violence, where we now have some very shoddy reporting by the New York Times, Screams Without Words, that many holes have been poked into about, like, the proliferation of sexual violence on October 7th, but the impulse to portray Palestinians as rapists is also a part of that propaganda effort.
Absolutely. And we're seeing it time and time again, even though, like you said, things have been proven, there's been fact, you know, people have found facts, you know, there's been human rights organizations that have said otherwise. But because these stereotypes are so powerful, and I don't know, I guess like there's the idea of like clickbait journalism as well. There's people, as you know, media organizations are still running with them. And it's so saddening to see that a few years on from October 7th, we're still seeing Palestinian men spoken about in this way, and also not afforded any sort of victimhood either. As you know, they're seen as, you know, complete terrorists and not seen as like kind of victims of a genocide, even though that is exactly what they are.
Yes, exactly. Can you speak about then also how the far right plays into this and their politics? Because, you know, white feminism is deployed by Sheryl Sandberg and corporate white liberals and, you know, in a work context, I would say. Mm-hmm. But it's also increasingly, like many liberal arguments, being absorbed into the right-wing ecosystem. And the far right, they're essentially neo-Nazis, pretend or use Muslim women as a tool to pretend like they care about them or to justify violence really against Muslim men, because they're using women as an object for that purpose. Describe how that's being done, particularly within the far right in Europe, where I think it's the most acute.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think what the kind of tenets or the arguments of white feminism have been, either with intent or without intent, which I guess doesn't really matter, but the far right have taken that and they've co-opted that kind of rhetoric to this idea of like saving women, you know, saving women and girls, which is a big kind of phrase that we're seeing in the UK and Europe, especially in the UK, where we are seeing a rise of the far right with Reform and Nigel Farage, and also in Europe as well. And yeah, they take this idea of saving women and girls, and also this idea of Muslim women need saving, like you said, to target Muslim men, because for them, Islam is seen as kind of the biggest enemy. It's also, I think, the easiest enemy to sell to people, especially, I guess, in the West, because we are seen as so inherently different to Western life or British values. And so it's something that the far right have, I guess, picked up on in the last a few decades, but especially recently, and have really run with it. And, you know, in Britain, the Reform, a lot of their policies do revolve around Islamophobia, around racism. They are, you know, on immigration as well. White feminism is really fed into that, even though, like you said, they don't really make sense. You know, it's, you know, white feminism is supposed to be seen as this liberal argument, and the far right, you know, like you said, is neo-Nazism as at this point, and fascism. But I think the far right have taken those arguments from white feminism and maybe even incorporated some white feminists into their ranks. And I think it's an easy way for them to defend themselves against misogyny, first and foremost, but also it's easy for them to attract more people into their ranks, I think, and people to vote for them. because they can say that they support women's rights, but a very particular set of women's rights, which is kind of the white feminist kind of women's rights, which is we will protect, you know, you and your community and protect your position of power in society. And we will give you X, Y, and Z. And for some people that works for them and that's what they want. And so that's how their feminism works in kind of the Western imagination. And I imagine it's probably the same for America as well.
Well, it also feeds into a narcissism that is inherent in this trope, which is the white savior complex, where you can support really odious, natalist, racist policies, and yet here's this prop of a Muslim woman that you're supposedly saving, and your racism is justified because this is the person you're saving from all of the other members of this faith or in this country that are oppressing them.
Mm, exactly. It's also fascinating for me, like, you're saving Muslim women from something, but no one ever really talks about what they're saving them to, because that part of the process isn't really that important. So you're, you know, they can, you know, far right can say, we want to save Muslim women. And so, for example, say you've saved them, but where are you saving them to? And so that part never really gets talked about because that's not important to them. They just want to do the talking about, like, oh, you know, life in the global south or in Muslim countries is violent, it's oppressive, look how their women are treated, they're not allowed to work, they're not allowed to be in education, all these stereotypes that we've heard time and time again. But we do, you know, they don't want to do anything about Muslim women in the West. They just want to focus on the stereotypes that exist.
Well, in fact, they want them to not come to...
Well, they want us to go back.
Yeah, go back and definitely don't immigrate here. Like, this also plays into kind of, I think, we have our fascist immigration policies here in the United States under Donald Trump, but that's more applied to those on our southern border, of course. But in Europe, you have a proximity to the Middle East that we do not. And so the anti-immigration nativism takes on an Islamophobic flavor that is even more pronounced than the United States. And we're pretty damn Islamophobic here.
Yeah. I also think there is this idea of, like we were saying earlier about imperialism, you know, that we have a lot of, you know, like you said, we have a lot of migrants coming from either the Middle East or from the global south, escaping, you know, God knows what, escaping war, violence, wanting to find a better life. And there's all these kind of far right groups complaining about, you know, oh, these migrants are coming over, whatever their complaints are, without ever really saying, like, what are they escaping from? Like, was it, you know, what was the context of their country? And, you know, a lot of the nations that we're seeing migration from had some sort of Western influence or Western, you know, power enacted onto it, either in this century or the last century. But I think the Europe and Britain are very good at kind of erasing the kind of their own role in that history. And we only kind of focus on the present without thinking about the historical context of migration as well.
I wanted to ask you about how you look at whiteness as a portrayal of innocence, right? Mm-hmm. So the white savior mentality and the white feminism also allows for history to begin then, to your point. Like, we don't have to have context. This simplifies it for you. You're good. You're doing something good, and whiteness is good. And that's how it sustains itself, this, like, morality without morality having to have any substance behind it. So whiteness equals moral, whiteness equals good. How much of that uplifts this, you know, horrifying stereotype about Muslim women?
Completely. I think this idea of, yeah, whiteness or white women equal goodness or innocence also relies on the dehumanization of other women, specifically, I think, in this case, Muslim women. Because if, you know, if that's kind of the innocent side of things, then I think the other side of things is, oh, well, because I think Muslim women are seen as in need of saving, I think, up until a point, as long as that Muslim woman is seen as, I guess, being like a quote-unquote good Muslim, if she's seen as deviating from any kind of, I guess, like, Western values or assimilation or anything like that, then she's seen as kind of deviating from that path. And then the savior complex doesn't always quite apply. I'm thinking of the case of Shamima Begum in the UK and how she went to Syria like 2015. And in the UK, that was a really big case. And when she wanted to move back to Britain and had that famous interview in the camps in Syria, that the savior complex no longer applied to her because she started to occupy a different stereotype, which was the stereotype of the female terrorist. So yeah, I think that is also kind of connected to this idea of kind of whiteness equals innocence or whiteness equals goodness. I'm also thinking of, like, I think they call it, like, quote unquote Karen behavior, like the idea of, like, white tears as well, and how that kind of plays into the kind of protection of whiteness as innocence and playing onto that, onto the kind of that ideal as well. But yeah, I do think they are related, and I think it really, they're both stereotypes kind of play on each other, and they both, that, yeah, Muslim women are dehumanized, I think, through this idea of kind of whiteness as innocence in a way.
I also wanted to ask you about the face coverings and the veil and how the hijab and face coverings have become a political flashpoint in Europe, in particular the state in different countries intervening to ban certain face coverings. Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, so we've seen a big rise in a lot of European nations banning the hijab, either in the workplace or in educational settings, or now I think in France we're starting to see just kind of in general public settings. France did kick this off, I think, back in 2001. They were the first nation in Europe to ban the hijab in some way. But yeah, there's been a fair few nations now that have developed some sort of legal framework or policy when it comes to Muslim women and how they wear the hijab or the niqab, which is the full face covering, in public. I think there's like Austria that have had some framework come in. Switzerland have banned both hijab. They've had got hijab bans, but they've also banned the building of new mosques. So that's kind of come into it as well. I know there's a few far right groups in the UK who want to also ban hijabs. And yeah, I think it's become quite normalized for states and governments to start talking about Muslim women's bodies as either political, you know, pawns in a political game, or just kind of objects where there's not the context of their humanity and their agency is kind of removed from these discussions, and they are just talked about as just kind of this piece of clothing that's become really politicized now in Europe. And I wouldn't be surprised really if we see more and more hijab bans as Islamophobia becomes even more normalized.
And it's just amazing that in one breath, a white feminist could say that an over-sexualization of women is anti-feminist, but then at the same time, they can talk about a hijab or a face covering and as anti-feminist as well. It's almost like their definition of feminism isn't based in kind of any principle. It's about proximity to capitalism oftentimes.
No, absolutely. Because, yeah, you talk about kind of agency and women being able to choose whatever they want to do, and this idea of, because I think, you know, white feminism has also kind of got that choice feminism at the heart of it as well. Like, oh, women should be able to do whatever they want to do, but not when it comes to Muslim women and, you know, choosing to wear the hijab or choosing to wear the full face covering or choosing to dress modestly. You know, I'm not saying there aren't women in the world who aren't forced to wear the hijab. That is completely, you know, there are some societies where that happens. But I would say mostly, especially in the West and Western nations, most Muslim women, if not the majority, are making the choice to wear the hijab. But when we have these hijab bans, or when white feminists start talking about hijab as a form of oppression, or how can you... You know, I've had settings where, I mean, I don't wear the hijab, but where I've been with my mother and someone has spoken to her and, you know, are like, oh, you were a doctor. That's amazing. And it's this kind of like heavy assumption that it doesn't make sense for her to be like an educated woman with a job and have this voice or be loud or anything like that. She doesn't quite fit the stereotype. So even, I think, well-meaning women or well-meaning anybody in society, still, I think that stereotype of especially a veiled Muslim woman is so deeply embedded, I think, in the Western imagination. And I think that has come from this white feminist rhetoric that has been reproduced time and time again.
It's also not to say, as you mentioned, that women being forced into face coverings, particularly in nations where there are Muslim theocracies mm-hmm. or religious governments, are not being oppressed. It's to say that it's being selectively applied in the West mm-hmm. for very specific purposes and to uphold really white supremacy and capitalism by making caricatures out of these women.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And I think it is completely connected to capitalism. it's something that I probably wanted to go into the book a bit more, but I think opening up capitalism probably would have been a second book in itself. Because I think, you know, we all remember like the girl boss capitalism of kind of like, oh, girl boss feminism of like 2016 and all the t-shirts with We Are Feminists on them. And I think maybe we've moved slightly away from that, but I think capitalism is so deeply embedded in kind of white feminism that, yeah, equality is seen as kind of, you know, gained through employment or gained through economic means. I think that then, you know, we focus on like female CEOs and female billionaires. You know, having a female billionaire doesn't really achieve anything for anyone else apart from that one woman. You know, this idea of having like a moral female billionaire makes no sense to me. But yeah, I think it really focuses on individualism rather than kind of collective liberation. I think that also really sits at the heart of white feminism as like an argument.
Can you talk about single issue oppression? This is a framework that you write about how Muslim women's lives are reduced to just their religion and their relationship with Islam.
Yeah, so this is a chapter in the book where I think one of the big parts of white feminism and its relationship to Muslim women is this idea that there is kind of a very one-way tunnel vision when it comes to how white feminists view Muslim women, and it is that they are viewed through the lens of faith and faith alone. So any other identity or intersection that a Muslim woman might occupy is neglected or ignored or just brushed aside. So the experiences of, for example, Black Muslim women, they are only seen through the lens of religion rather than the experiences of, you know, if a Black Muslim woman comes forward and says she's experienced racism or she's experienced colorism or anything that may be related to her race, white feminism either doesn't quite, you know, doesn't really comprehend it as an issue, or they link it back to it being an issue to do with their religious identity. Same with class, you know, if a, you know, a working class Muslim woman or a poor Muslim woman talks about maybe her experiences of growing up in poverty or experiences of not being able to access the workforce or anything that's maybe related to her economic identity, white feminism doesn't look at that as a issue of class or anything to do with an identity that isn't to do with her religion or faith. So yeah, it's this idea that we can only be oppressed by one aspect, and that is always faith, and everything else is seen, is not seen, is neglected completely from that conversation or from that experience.
The reduction, and we'll wrap shortly, but the reduction of Muslim women to just that piece of them really, I think, also works in tandem with the attempt to portray Muslims as savages more broadly, unenlightened, not cosmopolitan, like, and then that's really just a replication of capitalist inequality when you really think about it, and using Islamophobia for that end.
Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree. I think it really does go back to, I think all of this can go back to capitalism in its essence. If you really paired white feminism back, I think you would just find capitalism inequality at the heart of it.
Well, really appreciate your time today. People should definitely check out the book. Shahed Izadi. The book is called The Othered Woman, How White Feminism Harms Muslim Women. We will put a link down below in the video and episode descriptions and at majority.fm. Shahed is also an award-winning freelance writer, former editor at Bustle UK, and staff writer at Stylist Magazine. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me again.
Of course.
We are back, Matt Leck here with us, Brandon Sutton. Hey, Brandon.
Hi, Matt. How you doing?
I'm doing pretty good, pretty good. Good to be talking to you from the chair of authority here.
Yeah. You look so tall. I will say, you look really tall in that chair, Matt. Emma never looks as tall as you do in that chair.
AOC was in studio here, and I don't know if people have seen the picture I got with her on my Instagram, but I look about 7'1", like, and I've never looked more corn-fed in my entire life. Nice. Very tall, goofy guy, but yeah, I guess that's me. What's going on in the discourse?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, we just wrapped up our morning stream over on the Discourse with Brandon YouTube and Twitch account. Gosh, I don't even know what we did today other than cover all of the various ways in which Donald Trump is destroying America, the farming crisis. Obviously, I know you look surprised. Like, Donald Trump destroying America?
I thought he was making it great again.
Well, did you see how he's actually going to demolish the Kennedy Center now because they won't let him change the name?
That's great.
It's a shocking amount of work to basically have destroyed like parts of the White House. You're doing, and also, you know, this whole bunker underneath the ballroom.
Yeah.
For a while, I'm like, you know, I'm concerned. Whenever I hear continuity of government being talked about, that's a pretty scary concept. You can go down some rabbit holes about that sort of thing. Indeed, when there was a helicopter crash in the first month of the Trump administration, with that helicopter that was crossing over the Potomac and a plane was landing. That was continuity of government flights. And it's like, why are we planning for like emergency measures? That's a little bit strange, but I also think that Trump might just use anything available to him to get the ballroom built.
For sure.
National security is the best license ever.
Yeah, you know, it's one of those situations where I think that the military-industrial complex and Donald Trump have overlapping interests where they want to put a bunch of crazy stuff under the White House that, you know, I guess doesn't exist there right now, and he wants a ballroom. And so for a while, people thought that the crazy stuff under the, you know, White House ballroom was a conspiracy, even though Trump would speak to it. But it might be real. It just might only be an excuse for Trump to make the ballroom.
Exactly.
Which is, I think, a lot different than people expected. Like, they thought he secretly wanted the bunker, but no, he really wants the ballroom, and the bunker is actually an excuse. And then, like, I don't know, the Pentagon wants the bunker.
Exactly. It's the easiest way to get what you want is to just team up with the military-industrial complex.
Exactly.
He should have had them help with the pool as well, I think.
How's that going? Is that going well?
Well, they did drop charges against the Olympian that...
The Olympian.
They did.
There's footage today of more of it chipping away, kind of proving that it wasn't his X-Acto blade or whatever he was using. It's like crusting up and falling apart right now.
Yeah, I mean, I'm surprised that he let it go so quickly. I heard that he was trying to throw Jeanine Pirro under the bus for it and get it reignited.
Yes, yeah. Pirro got in a shouting match with the governor of my home state, North Dakota, Doug Burgum. Doug Burgum, who sold a software company to Bill Gates, and that's why he's a billionaire. And now leveraged
Bill Gates
to be a yes man for Trump and say, yes, sir, it wasn't the bad contractor that you decided upon. It was secret malevolent forces that hate America, including this Olympic athlete. Doug Burgum was going on the Sunday shows talking about that, and Jeanine Pirro apparently was pissed at him because he wasn't giving her a lot to work with as the person who was actually trying to prosecute people for those sorts of things by blabbing it about the press. It is very interesting, like, a lot of these cases fall apart, whether it's like anti-ICE stuff. It's like, we're going to throw the book. You remember that guy that like threw the burrito?
Yeah, the sandwich.
And then they made the highlight reel about going to his door at like 2 a.m. And then that got thrown out by the jury.
A lot of people think that's why Pam Bondi got, you know, the axe eventually, because she was bad at these political prosecutions. Because, you know, this is part of a tapestry of retribution acts he's engaging in. And it's just the one that he requires, I think, a lot more outward approval from the judicial system in order to execute sometimes. Right. But all of the firings being done by like the new acting director of like the new DNI, who I think is still Bill Pulte, all of the, you know, cleaning house being done at the FBI by Kash Patel, that doesn't necessarily require so much approval. And then he also got the approval from the Supreme Court recently to fire some people, like some particular like head of an agency as well. So, I mean, it's just when he meets up against any kind of, I think, resistance from a theoretically unbiased body, he just has to let it go. But he's not really, you know, able to deal with that, I think, emotionally very well, very maturely, I should say.
Yeah. There does seem to be a self-defeating element to this, I guess, power grab that, like, you know, we're going to have a shock on toilet paper prices leading into the midterms. Did you remember what happened during COVID? Like, people went absolutely crazy about toilet paper. It's pretty important to the American psyche. So that's all around the discourse. That was your stream this morning. People should go check that out. Very, very good show.
It's all right. People say they like it. I don't know what they're smoking, but I hope it's good.
It's fun and interesting topics done in an intelligent way, and that sounds way too dry when I put it that way, but it is very good.
Oh,
what are you going to say, Brandon?
I was going to say we also watched a bunch of police officers being arrested for flock camera violations and also just like freaking out on the job. There's a lot of videos out there of police behaving badly, a lot of sheriffs specifically.
Really? Any highlights that you want to share?
Oh, yeah. So we yesterday watched a bunch of videos about like police departments in smaller areas who have, you know, what they call second chance officers, which are officers who have been fired from bigger police departments and just need a, you know, a little bit of help to get back into the blue. And turns out a lot of those officers just, I don't know, they're just not ready for the authority. And so you get a lot of like road rage incidents, lying, you know, things like that.
Police officers?
I know, never. It's so surprising.
What did you call them? Second chance officers?
Yeah, second chance officers, like a Make-A-Wish Foundation type thing.
I was just
going
to say that. It sounds
officers.
Like Make-A-Wish. Like my wish is to be a, you know, a police officer. Fascinating. I feel very safe. It's very good that our sheriff departments are second chance cases like that. What did I just watch? No, never mind. I'm not going to get on that. Matt Binder, welcome to the program. Good to see you.
Hey, it's good to see you guys too. What's going on?
Not much. We're just doing plugs. Do you want to get in?
Yeah.
Plug
Boys Day. I'm having a bit of a Boys Day, Matt.
Oh, yeah. Sushi. We got to break out the sushi.
I know. We need sushi.
Oh,
poker.
I might have
sushi.
Sushi
with the boys.
Got my poker chips. I'm going to cut them right here.
You're gonna start bragging about winning $200 whole. I mean, don't get me wrong, $200 is a lot of money to me. But if I was a regular gambler, I don't know if people know what I'm talking about. Tim Pool was bragging about how he was like a really smart gambler and was bragging about like spending $400 something and walking away with $600 something. And it's like, listen, I mean, I would brag about that because I'm not a gambler, but for someone who claims to be a regular at the poker table, I don't know, that seems like low stakes. Am I right?
Yeah, that's nothing. That's nothing.
That's fascinating. We might need to watch
I think
that.
You're so rude. I remember when I was watching Casino Royale with Daniel Craig, and in that scene where they're all playing like Baccarat or whatever they're playing, across from that like sumo guy and all of the other ethnic minorities, Tim Pool was just sitting there. Like just beanie on, like eyes like, occluded by a visor. You guys are remember this. Like, Tim Pool is big. Exactly. Tim Pool is really big in this community.
Like I've seen a lot of casino movies, and I've seen movies where they count cards and all sorts
rounders.
Of things. And they always brag about, you know, big wins. I don't recall like them running off with $200.
Yeah. The person at the payout window isn't even paying attention when they're like cashing that out. They're like,
I will also point out that in a previous episode of the Tim Pool Show, which we've been watching a lot of recently, and I can't say I'm happy about that, he bragged about making $3,400 or something per hour, which I don't know if that's before or after like the tax on ruples or whatever, but yeah. It seems like if he only made $200 playing poker, that's like a loss of money.
Right. Like I mean, to me...
He wasted time.
To me, the thing that I would really be bragging about if you're trying to impress people with money-making skills is the $150,000 or whatever it was per month he was making from spread Russian – just be himself and spread things that the Russians wanted to hear. I mean, that is amazing. $200 at the poker table, that's not that crazy to me.
Yeah, all that money for self-actualization and still has to wear the beanie into the Mandalay Bay or wherever he's gambling at.
It's a tuxedo beanie, though.
Binder, you want to... did you plug or...
Just youtube.com/Matt Binder. Subscribe. I'm almost at that nice round 40,000 subscriber number. So let's get there.
Nice.
Very nice. Well, folks, Left Reckoning, we had Beto O'Rourke on talking about if Democrats can be in a coalition with people who take AIPAC money, as well as Zora Mamdani, and how we can get low propensity voters to start voting again. So I appreciate Beto O'Rourke taking the time to talk with us. Go check that out, patreon.com/leftreckoning. That will be a, like every Sunday, a members only Sunday show this weekend. So check that out, patreon.com/leftreckoning, and we will see you after the break.
Okay, Emma, please.
Well, I feel that my voice is sorely lacking on the majority report.
Wait, whoa. Look, Sam is unpopular.
I do deserve a vacation at Disney World. So, ladies and gentlemen, it is my pleasure to welcome Emma to the show.
It is Thursday.
I think you need to take over for Sam.
Yes, please.
No, I'm gonna pause you right there.
Wait, what?
You can't encourage Emma to live like this. And I'll tell you why. So it's offered a tour, sushi, and poker with the boys. Sushi and poker with the boys. Someone's offered a tour.
Yeah.
Sushi and poker with the boys.
What?
Tour. Sushi and poker.
Tim's upset.
Tour. Yeah. Sushi and poker with the boys. Someone's offered a tour. Sushi and
that's what we call the biz.
Tour. Sushi and poker with the boys.
Right.
Tour. Sushi and poker.
We're gonna get demonetized.
I just think that what you did to Tim Pool was mean.
Free speech.
That's not what we're about here. Look at how sad he's become now. You shouldn't even talk about it. I think you're responsible.
I probably am in a certain way, but let's get to the meltdown here.
Twerk. Ugh. Sushi and poker with the boys.
Oh my god.
Twerk.
Wow.
Sushi.
I'm sorry. I'm losing my fucking mind.
Someone's offered a twerk.
Yeah.
Sushi and poker with the boys.
Logic.
Twerk. Sushi and poker with the boys. Boy.
Twerk. I think I'm like a little kid. I think I'm like a kid. Twerk. I think I'm like a little kid.
Add this debate 7,000 times.
A little kid. Think I'm like a little kid. Little kid. Think I'm like a kid. Twerk.
I'm losing my fucking mind.
Some people just don't understand.
So I'm not trying to be a dick right now, but like, I absolutely think the U.S. should be providing me with a wife and kids.
That's not what we're talking about here.
Okay, all right. It's not a fun job.
Twerk.
That's a real thing. That's real thing.
Boy. Willy Wonka.
Twerk.
That's a real thing.
That's real thing.
What's that offered to
twerk? That's a real thing. That's real thing.
Boy. That's
twerk.
A real thing.
That's real thing.
What's that offered to twerk?
Ladies and gentlemen, Joe Rogan has done it again.
That offered to twerk?
That's a real thing.
That's poker with the boy.
I think he might be blowing it out of proportion.
Real thing.
That's poker with the boys.
That offered to twerk?
That's a real thing.
That's poker.
Let's go, Joe.
Twerk. Sushi and poker with the boys.
Take it easy, Tim.
Twerk. Sushi and poker.
Things have really gotten out of hand.
Sushi and poker with the boys.
Delusional.
Twerk.
Deluded.
Sushi.
You don't have a clue as to what's going on. Live YouTube.
Sam has like the weight of the world on his shoulders.
Poggers.
Sam doesn't want to do this show anymore.
Can't do it anymore.
It was so much easier when the majority report was just you. You were happy.
Let's change the subject.
Rangers and Knicks are doing great.
Now shut up. Don't want people saying reckless things on your program.
That's one of the most difficult parts about this show.
This is a pro-killing podcast.
I'm thinking maybe it's time we bury the hatchet.
Left is best. Trump. Violet.
Twerk.
Don't be foolish and don't fucking tweet at me and don't bitch. The way Emma has cucked all of these people.
Love it.
That's where my heart is, so yeah. I wrote my honors thesis about it.
Oh, she wrote an honors thesis. I guess I should hand the main mic to you now.
You are to the right of me on foreign policy.
We already fund Israel, dude. Are you against that?
That's a tougher question. I have an answer to.
Incredible theme song.
Hi, Bumbler.
Emma Viglin, absolutely one of my favorite people. Actually, not just in the game, like, period.
We are back. Welcome back to the program. I'm going to try to fit into this little window that Sam fits into.
Uh-oh. Hype-mogging Sam.
Let's start with some serious business first, Brian, if we could, before we get to the fun stuff. I want to do this pretty sound. Not a year has passed since the killing of Alex Pretty and Renee Good in Minnesota last January. Was sort of an inciting event in, I think, turning the tide against at least the Kristi Noem-led Department of Homeland Security, ICE sort of push into occupation of American cities that continues now just a little bit under the radar. Good Morning America talked with Alex Pretty's family, and let's just watch this and then I'll react to that. But they still haven't been contacted by anyone in the administration about the murder of their son by these goons.
I was all over the news. We watched it on mm-hmm. TV, and I was like, that's mm-hmm. our son. Mm-hmm. That's Alex. And they killed him. No one called us. No one.
We still haven't heard from him.
Yeah. That's how we found out. Watching it on TV. Watching our son be shot 10 times on TV.
In the back.
In the back.
Trying to help someone.
Trying to help somebody.
Trying to help someone.
And being beaten mm-hmm. with tear gas canisters, sprayed with tear gas.
Mm-hmm. With a camera in one hand and his left hand.
Empty.
Empty in the air.
When you saw the beginning of the video, what were you seeing?
I saw his jacket, to be honest.
I think it was his jacket.
Yeah.
Yeah. And his sunglasses.
His sunglasses. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it didn't surprise you that from the beginning, it seemed like he was trying to come to the aid of someone else.
I was not shocked that he helped somebody. My shock is that he was murdered, and no one has given us the complete truth, or anyone has been held accountable. And it's been 7 months.
There was more effort in vilifying him than pursuing justice, investigating this.
So that's where we are. I applaud Good Morning America in giving this story some attention. I've been wondering this entire time these ICE occupations have gone on, what the American press was talking about during, I mean, I guess they're talking about the war, Japanese internment, right? Like, but like the way these news organizations talk about Hassan Piker or any other bullshit. And we have goon squads going around killing people. We have a guy in Texas custody who the Minnesota officials want extradited back to their state to face charges. And the Texas authorities are saying no. And they will rather let that guy go free who shot somebody and that shot through a door in pursuit of somebody, hitting the guy he was pursuing's roommate, and then lied and said, I was actually under assault. And the charges against those two that he shot through their door of were dropped because it was abundantly apparent that, once again, shock among shocks, these supposed law enforcement agents lie when these fatal or near-death incidents occur. And that's just, we're still like acting as if it's, what's radical in this country is some people are saying abolish ICE. I don't know, your guys' reaction.
Oh, no. I mean, I think we can agree that what's radical in this country is accountability for certain people and certain types of people. And that includes law enforcement agents, right? It might surprise you to know that during the internment of Japanese people in America, the mainstream press supported it. Right. Up until the point, and I will even say they supported it and sometimes even called them concentration camps up until the point in which like the Axis powers were found out to be having their own concentration camps. And then they started to make like distinctions, right? Distinctions between our camps and their camps, which we're also familiar with seeing now when it comes to the atrocities America commits. But in the case of the media and law enforcement, I think that we're seeing across the board, there is a desire to make sure people don't decide that law enforcement broadly is a problem and not just ICE, right? That law enforcement broadly lie and not just ICE officers. And part of that is just not even accepting that ICE officers aren't anomalous. In fact, a lot of them come from other law enforcement agencies. They're the worst of the worst cops. They're the worst of the worst, ex-soldiers. They're the worst of the worst, like post-military veterans. And like they have gravitated towards ICE because they've been unchained in their ability to abuse minorities, right? And so these people didn't come from anywhere. They're just other, you know, parts of our system being concentrated in ICE, an agency that simply shouldn't exist.
Yeah, I mean, that's actually a really good point. And a lot of these incidents, including, I believe, the murder of Alex Pretty, were committed by guys who had been not just like new recruits post like 2024 to ICE, but people who have been there since like the Obama administration. And I'm curious, like, how this, we're in this moment now where there are a record levels of detentions happening, but they're not doing it as publicly as they were last year. But they are doing a lot of the going after the soft, easy targets, which are like people that are either just driving around and look Hispanic, and they pull them over and find out they're not even that they're undocumented, that they aren't full citizens, and maybe going through some kind of process, or even like more depraved, it's hard to say more relative, also depraved. They are sitting at courthouses waiting for people that are actively pursuing the process to get documented, and they are waiting for them there because one, they know that they'll have to be there, but also because they know that they're not going to go to court armed. And so they're going to be in a position where they are have to care even less or worry even less about their safety. And it's crazy.
And airports and schools and hospitals, like they have a new 2000 arrest or day quota or something like that. And they've always been going after soft targets, not just because they're cowards, but because there just aren't that many criminal migrants in this country the way that like people have been told. Right now, the United States government expands their understanding to be, well, anyone in this country undocumented is a criminal. But most people don't think of that as like the real type of criminal migrant. They think of all of these like murderers and rapists who are so supposedly in our country who came across the border, or Al-Qaeda sleeper cell agents. But that's just a fiction. That's a fiction that is meant to like obscure what is actually happening, which is that, you know, immigrants are being used as a way to erode all of our civil rights.
Absolutely.
Right, right. And of course, a lot of people don't realize this until, this is really like the conservative right wing like pattern here. They don't realize this until it happens to them. Like there's been countless stories, now. I feel like it's almost every other day, if not every day, where some 2-3-time Trump voter comes out and says they took my wife or husband or fiance or boyfriend or girlfriend or whomever, brother-in-law, mother-in-law, and they go, but they, my family member did nothing wrong. They weren't a criminal, because you know they wanted to see this happen to other people. I think we need to be honest with this too. Like they wanted to see this happen to other people, and they never considered it would happen to them, because they don't view it when it's their doing, they don't view it as anything wrong. Like my family member may have come over here the same way that the ones ICE has already picked up came over here, but those people must have done something else wrong too, because otherwise why would ICE go get them? You know, but we know that's not the case. And unfortunately, it takes this happening to them for them to realize that, oh, well, maybe, just maybe, that wasn't the case for those other people, too. You know, it's at least they're hopefully opening their eyes, at least some of them.
No, I mean, that's a great point, Matt. And I think it's important to also acknowledge that because a lot of people view that as rude to acknowledge that a lot of these people just were unable to see their own stakes or the stakes for people that they love in the kinds of language that they were normalizing or championing under Trump. But that is a strategic thing that has been done to people in the United States, not just for immigration, but for foreign policy, but for the expansion of the surveillance state, for all of these things that are happening around us. so that people can see them happen to other people on television a block over from them and not realize that that is a direct reflection of what the government, at the very least, would love to get away with against you. And at the worst, and much more recently, I mean, people have really started to understand it's what the government is going to try to roll out against you next week, essentially, right? You know, and it's not even just Republicans. I think it's a problem that a lot of Americans have, a lot of people in the West have, where they're just so convinced that they're special because of all of the like hyper individualism and like hyper competitive narratives that come as part of the American, like, I think, project now, that they have to be special and that these things that are happening to other people will just never happen to them. It could never happen to them. What's going on in Gaza can never happen over here because I'm special. What's happening to those people can never happen to me. And I think it's gotten really bad to the point where people can see things happening to their neighbor and be absolutely sure that it won't happen to them. Because it's not even just like people who voted for Trump. It's also like veterans. I was watching this story where over 50 people who are currently serving in the military right now, including people who are on the USS Lincoln, have had their family members, like spouses or parents, taken by ICE.
Yeah, I was talking with Brian about that. Like, you know, obviously, probably, I mean, I just can't imagine how insane I would go. Like, you hear about this 19-year-old father of a 3-year-old who jumped overboard in the USS Lincoln and is now being charged for malingering. And the quotes he had given his wife are like, this boat is starting to really get to me. They're going stir crazy in that. And then you add that onto the fact that you're fighting for a country that is literally kidnapping your parents. And it's not a surprise to me that, for instance, was it the USS Harry Truman, the one in the got the laundry room fire?
Gerald Ford.
I'm shocked that hasn't happened more. I'm not surprised at all to see people scrawling in dust on airplane wings, like BB's cucks and that sort of stuff. Like, this is there's no amount of therapy. Again, people are mentioning mental health in the context of the soldier who jumped overboard. There's no amount of therapy that is going to make the Great War on Terror equivalent to, like, fighting the Nazis. Because this entire thing has been a fucking sham. It has been a military-industrial horror show all these years. What was that, Brian? Oh, good. Let's do something here. I haven't seen this yet, but I saw this on the sound sheet, and it sounds very interesting. Kyle Clark, the Colorado Killer, as we call him in the media. He's got a new target. This time, a guy named Victor Marx. He's going after Marxism, folks. This brand of Marxism has a Colorado GOP candidate who... this is the guy who was forced to, kill a man. Okay,
Clark interviewed him, and he refused to admit whether or not he had killed other people.
Right, okay. And now he turns out he's pocketing money that was meant to support his campaign.
I believe he was asked, like, because he said he was forced to kill somebody when he was a child. And then I believe he said, have you killed anybody since then? And he said, I don't see why that's relevant, I believe was his quote. The answer very likely could be no, but he's just trying to be some macho
sense of mystery. Yeah, exactly. That's
well, I mean, honestly, if we don't get to know if Mitch McConnell is alive, I don't see why we get to know if this guy has killed somebody. Right. It's a HIPAA violation, right? Is that what we've been told?
Yeah, I didn't know if I've ever killed anybody. But yeah, here's Kyle Clark. And the Victor Marx campaign would not comment, which is, I wouldn't either if I was the campaign. Here is Kyle Clark.
Access to the Republican candidate for governor. $1,300 gets you a meeting with Victor Marx and some campaign merchandise kicked in. We've been following the money to an out-of-state company that hides who owns it, a company that we've now learned is owned by Victor Marx. His campaign says the purchases support the campaign's efforts. They have not yet answered our questions about whether Victor Marx himself is pocketing his supporters' money.
hundreds of thousands of people around the nation saying, I'm going to send a donation. I'm going to support the campaign.
Every candidate asks for money. Republican gubernatorial candidate Victor Marks is just very particular about where it goes.
Another way people can support us is go to Victor2026merch.com. If they order merchandise, there's no limit on that.
That's right.
They can order as much as they want. That will really help us.
Marks brushes off other Republicans, calling him a con man and a grifter. He suggests his supporters can make unlimited purchases from his merchandise store, where they sell meetings with Marks for $1,300. His campaign said, quote, every purchase helps spread the message across Colorado and supports the campaign's grassroots efforts.
This is just patently illegal. Like, this is patently something that can't happen.
When campaign finance attorneys like Mario Nicholas told us that would be obviously illegal, Marks' attorney said the money wasn't going to the campaign, where it'd be subject to legal limits. But they wouldn't say where the money's going.
What I've been authorized to say is that, look, for a period of time, the campaign allowed a third party, right, to sell its merchandise.
The Marks merchandise store emails
want more of this guy. Who is this? A campaign official? That is, I mean, to look at like lower, because like it's not like even the official White House spokespeople are any sort of seem at all credible. But to be sort of a lower level like spokesperson for this type of crook is fascinating to me, and to have this sort of dry, actually, we had a third-party vendor, and we are done with that now.
Good. Wait, but a third-party vendor for meetings with the mayor, that's not even really a product. Like, they're trying to say that they were just selling really expensive, like, designer items, like how Trump tries to get away with the Trump mobile thing. But one of those items was, like, a meeting for $1,300.
Literal access.
He should have a Patreon.
It's just merch.
And it's not limited, so you can buy as much as you want.
You could buy $2 billion worth of tumblers.
They should have like a little tip thing, too, where it's like you can, even if you want to pay like $40,000 for that T-shirt, you can pay for it. There's no limit on
pay
that.
Pay what you want.
I want to get this guy. Let's see this one more time.
Where it'd be subject to legal limits, but they wouldn't say where the money's going.
What I've been authorized to say is that, look, for a period of time, the campaign...
What I've been authorized to say, like, you don't work at Area 51.
Also, didn't they say he was, like, the campaign manager or campaign head? Like, you weren't authorized to say by who? You? Like, yourself? Like, you...
This is, I mean, it's lawyers. Funny, but it's also like, this is like a corporatization or like a corporate obfuscation of what democracy should be. Like, what do you mean you're not authorized? Okay, all right, let's go. What I'm authorized to say with my...
What I've been authorized to say is that, look, for a period of time, the campaign allowed a third party, right, to sell its merchandise.
The Marks merchandise store emails now carry a disclaimer. Paid for by Not Shook LLC. No such company registered in Colorado. We found Not Shook LLC registered in Wyoming, where its owners can remain anonymous. And that's where the Marks merch money trail would have gone cold, if not for an obscure campaign finance filing in Colorado, where Not Shook LLC paid the Marks campaign $5,000 for a logo licensing fee. Colorado campaign finance law requires an LLC making a contribution to identify its owner, also called a member. And there it is, Victor Marks himself.
Victor Marks has been called the con man before, and this is just one more con that he's playing on people. Only I think that the problem is he's going to get caught doing it.
Months ago, the Marks campaign bragged its merchandise operation brought in almost $200,000 so far. The campaign has not responded to our latest questions about the anonymous out-of-state company that leads back to Victor Marks, and our questions about whether Marks is lining his own pockets with his supporters' money.
I mean, who's to say that you can't own the third party involved, right? I mean,
the law, I guess. That campaign finance
lawyer really mean, right? What does that really mean?
Some people speak in third person. So, I mean, that can kind of be the same thing, I suppose. Maybe he's having a dissociated episode. Like, he's like a Tyler Durdening himself. But I will say, I think that Trump has emboldened scammers.
Yes,
every year we have a new George Santos drop. George Santos is still around, too.
That's the real submerged part of society, I am convinced. I remember we got a fascinating call like in the first Trump term from somebody in Florida. And I think the show with Kirsten Dunst, I'm Becoming a God in Central Florida, sort of captured this a little bit, which is a great show. Everyone should watch. It's only one season. But the person was basically like, yeah, like everyone's like in my or it's very prevalent to run scams in my community. And all the scammers are loving Donald Trump. And that might be a significant voting block. I think, like, relative to, like, people who want to continue to support Israel, I bet there's more people who, like, want to be represented by somebody who makes it easier to scam people in America.
There's a lot of used car salesmen, crypto guys, like, nebulous sales cucks, like the PBD boys. He's, like, their patron saint. They're, like, Google Gobble, one of us, when they see him go on the news and have one of his, like, episodes.
Yeah. I mean, exactly, like the crypto thing, exactly right. John Ossoff, who also just condemned Hassan Piker like a little, you know, loser. But he's out here talking about I'm anti-corruption and he's soft on crypto. Like, we know what these definitions mean, John. Like, you can't put a documentary gloss on that very obvious contradiction. What's this we got here?
Well, before we call
this guy,
there's a belief
in this country that you know, if you give a scam a sort of professional facade, that it's a legitimate business, then it's an okay scam to do. I mean, we see it with multi-level marketing schemes. Yep. We see it with all sorts of shady businesses that, as long as, like, you know, you're not, you know, showing the watches in a trench coat. If you show the fake watches, or in this case, you know, crypto or whatever the latest schemes are, in a professional setting, it's legit. It doesn't matter that you're still bilking people out of their money and providing them of something with no real value, or selling them something based on false advertising. As long as it's presented in a legitimate setting, then it's okay to do in this country.
Yep, and that's why Trump is president.
Wait, but before we call Victor Marx a con artist, do you really think a guy who runs the Pedophile Hunter Fund is a con artist? This is through his church, his Pedophile Hunter Fund.
I love this sort of thing where they talk about, like, our combined 20-plus years of experience. That's, like, the classic, like...
20 guys put a year in.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly.
And the experience was, like, obsessively following the dumbest shit online.
Yeah, the NBA rookie team has a combined experience of 12 years.
Yeah, exactly. First half stream, by the way. I have some IMs here besides just the one telling us to close the stream. Thank you, MIDI doctors, for that. Let's see, man. I do not know how these guys look at these IMs. These are old. I'm a little bit confused by this. So I might not. I'm going to call into the system though. So maybe we'll take some calls. I'm not 100% sure. But let's do the Gillis thing after you're ready with the first stream, Brian. Messages. Okay, I got to have that open, I think. Sorry, just
gosh, I kind of want some of his merch now, actually, though. Is that bad to get some of his merch? Because I feel like it's going to be a collector's item in a few weeks.
I thought you were saying you wanted to do your own merch.
I want Victor Marx's merch. If he's willing to go to jail for it, I think it's definitely worth the purchase.
I hate to say that. Of all the political merch that I've gotten, and I did contribute to Obama's 2012 race by buying his Scotch glasses. I bought Bernie t-shirts in 2016 and 2020, I think it was. The one that I like the most is the Jeb Bush glasses that we have somewhere around here.
Oh, the Jeb exclamation mark, yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. Jeb! Jeb!
Did you see he was glazing up Trump a few months ago?
Jeb was?
Yeah, he was, because he's a big anti-Cuba guy. And so he was giving one of those speeches in Florida. Like, his wife, I think, is a Cuban expat, but he's a big anti-Cuba guy. So, like, he was really glazing up Trump for his amping up antagonism against Cuba. So debasing.
God. Yeah, I knew Jeb's wife was of some kind of Latino descent, because there's that famous quote from his father, George H.W., on the White House lawn, where he said, "You see that little brown one there? That's my grandkid. Can you believe it?" Something like that. It's like a famous old quote from H.W.
Beautiful. This country was good before Trump came around.
You know what my favorite famous Jeb Bush quote is? Please clap. So
that's the greatest one.
How the family have fallen.
Please clap.
Good old Jeb. Let's talk about a continued exodus from the right by a lot of the media figures some of these guys, I don't really know who Tim Bartley is, to be honest. I don't watch Matt and Shane's secret podcast. I never really took Shane to be that political, but he's definitely in that Hinchcliffe adjacent sort of sphere. I mean, Austin, I guess is what you call it, right? There's this thing I saw, I believe it was Ebb and Flow, pointed this part out of the Matt and Shane secret podcast, where they're talking about some pushback they're getting from their right-wing audience that I found was amusing. Is
this in fallout from the Rogan podcast he did?
With, I believe, Hunter Biden, yeah. Or was it with Shane being on?
I'm talking about with Shane, where remember he was distancing himself and expressing regret for going to that UFC fight on the White House lawn.
Oh, yes, that's right.
And saying
right.
He stood in the rain as opposed to getting his picture taken.
Getting his picture taken, yeah, exactly. I do like the intentionality that Shane is bringing to some of these comments here. But yeah, let's hear what they had to say.
With Hunter, I'm completely libbed out.
Yeah, I said
we should. Dude, Biden never traded a single stock in office.
I said we should have free healthcare. I'm a lib now, too. Done. I fucking hate podcasts. You get drunk, you go, why don't we have free healthcare? People are like, fuck you, you fucking bitch, pussy. Shit. All right, my bad. Yeah. I don't know anything.
That is a funny one to be like, fuck that. It's like, okay, well, sounds nice.
Yeah, the people holding it down for the insurance companies.
Yeah. Okay, although my theory is our military.
Yeah. Before we get into the, I mean, somewhat intuitive policy discussion here, it is just fascinating to me to imagine what that must be like, to where you can't, like, the thing, because there are things that you could say here that would piss off our audience.
Oh, for sure.
But it's not. Healthcare should be cost prohibitive.
Oh, yeah. But the right-wing audience are just, like, irrationally angry about anything that they've been told is lib-coded, because there's just, like, a human centipede effect from, like, the health insurance companies to, like, the Republicans to, like, Joe Rogan, essentially, to these, like, feeder fund Joe Rogan shows, right? This, like, whole ecosystem of, like, right-wing podcasts that are in that kind of Rogan comedian space, who are just, like, you know, fourth or third generation slop purveyors. And so, like, yeah, like, their audience is listening to all that stuff because they've just been feeding it to them. It's just it's part of that this lib-coded culture that they're supposed to hate, like men and women's sports and free health care and like 15-minute cities and things like that. Like, they don't know why they hate it. They just have like an irrational antagonism to it. Like, 15-minute cities, that's feminine. I won't be able to drive my truck. Like, it's all very, very silly.
It's fascinating the way this argument comes into focus when it stops being about whether women should be allowed to have abortions or whether trans people should be allowed to have gender-affirming care. Because those are the exact same arguments made against women and trans people that broadly conservatives make against regular people for healthcare, which is that there needs to be Republican politicians involved in this process, and you cannot trust doctors and patients themselves to be the ones that are empowered over these decisions. But of course you don't need, and so when it comes to talking about universal health care, you see somebody like Jesse Waters say, well, it's MAHA, which surprised that
surprise
that MAHA turned out to be just a placeholder in place of what actually we needed with universal health care. Don't go to the hospital every time you have little sniffles, i.e.
Yeah.
You poor people would tax our services too much if we allowed you through the door too much. And the truth is that people like Jesse Waters and the people, rich people he represents that like to watch him spew this sort of shit every day, they need to be taxed more and pay for this stuff.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a certain type of alpha male guy in our society who's very susceptible to narratives that the public sector is inherently feminizing because it treats you like the nanny state. It doesn't allow you to have personal responsibility. It tells you that you don't get to choose to do this or that, like really, you know, superficial things. And so they're very willing to agree to like deregulate, to get rid of all of these different types of bureaucracies because they imagine it's keeping them from making the most masculine decisions possible, which tend to just be dying of salmonella, apparently. But yeah, I mean, so I think a lot of this stuff makes sense to them in a way that if you aren't so, I think, easily conditioned to think of yourself as like the apex of humanity, it becomes harder for you to understand, like, why shouldn't we test for screw worms? Like, why shouldn't we, inspect these farms? It's like, well, because my stomach will turn out. Exactly. Innovation. My stomach will figure it out.
We're going to have types of diarrhea they only dreamed about in the Middle Ages. In Nevada, says Robin Reno, in Nevada, some of the most vocal Trump supporters are people associated with casinos, strip clubs, and ranches. It's not for his politics or what MAGA sees. It's because they literally respect another criminal, a hustler. The rancher divide is very interesting. In North Dakota, my home state, historically speaking, it's more red now, but the divide was very clearly between like the dairy farmers or soybean farmers on the eastern part of the state and the ranchers on the west, which are very right wing and pretty paranoid type of people.
Because the soybean farmers, their customers are soy boys. So, I mean, yeah. They got to side with the left, right?
Julian, unfortunately, in Alabama. Hey, Matt, since you are a gaming guy of the MR crew, I'd love to know your thoughts about the Rockstar drama and the leaker that's plugging bullshit crypto. I've not followed this. I personally think it's hilarious that gamers, a mostly conservative group that like to say the R word. I think that's a little bit reductive. Are bitching about price and ownership but don't have shit to say about actually commodity people need like energy, groceries, etc. I don't know. Have you guys seen the crypto part of the Rockstar drama?
I've been covering it. Yeah. So I know about it. So there's this leaker or leakers. They just go by Cyberleak, LEEK, like the vegetable leak. And they've been leaking GTA 6 footage pretty much on a daily basis. And they embed a crypto token, a meme coin bearing their name, Cyberleak, over all the videos. They've been promoting it nonstop. In fact, when they would poll people on their website about what type of footage should they leak next, to take the poll, you were required to buy in to their meme coin. They've made something like, from what I've seen, a couple of tens of thousands of dollars, maybe as much as $50,000 off of the fees associated with the coin, but they themselves haven't sold any of their own holdings yet, which I believe is in the hundreds of thousands of dollars of worth of their token, which of course, the second they sell it, that coin will be worthless because they own the majority of it. That's pretty much it. It's unclear exactly who the leaker is. It does seem like they actually have a playable version of the game. Like they didn't like hack into some Rockstar Games like Dropbox where they were holding some like pre-recorded footage for like marketing purposes.
Right.
It appears that they actually are playing the game and taking the footage from the game itself. It's not clear how much of the game they have because what they have shown has been very limited. Mm-hmm. But they did. So, you know, so far people haven't been that pissed about it because it's just been basic gameplay footage, not really spoiling anything up until yesterday when they posted like a 4.5 minute clip of storyline, which people weren't happy about because that actually spoils the game. But yeah, that's it so far. That's the Netflix is going to drop an extended look at 3 p.m. today of the game, which appears to be like Rockstar Games' way of shutting down the leaker or at least making the leaks not as notable.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, to be honest, like, that's mildly interesting. I'm not anticipating this game so much, so I haven't watched any of the leaks or, like, sought any of them out. I've played all the Grand Theft Auto games, starting with Grand Theft Auto 3, and enjoyed them very much. But I was at a birthday party years ago, and it just so happened that somebody there worked for Rockstar Games, and this was in the lead up to Red Dead Redemption 3. And my naive ass was like, "Oh, that's awesome! Like, tell me about working at Rockstar." And very quickly became apparent that they hated their life there, and it was a terrible place to work. So that has sort of muted my enthusiasm for this, and also just being a little bit older. So I'm not really anticipating Grand Theft Auto, the new one, that much. I maybe will play it down the line, but I'm not going to, I'm not a console gamer, so I'm not going to be buying it day one anyway. But that's what I would want to see from a leaker is maybe leveraging that sort of stuff instead of for crypto gain, maybe for like labor rights at the company.
That's what they've been claiming on, or whoever the leaker is, under the guise that they're doing it to protest like what gaming has become with you know, downloadable add-on payable content and all that stuff. But you know, the way they're promoting the meme coin runs pretty opposite any sort of greater good that they claim to stand for.
Yeah, I'll be honest. I mean, maybe you guys think differently. I think the labor issue is more vital to me, or important in this context, than the microtransactions.
Oh, yeah, for sure. But again, not to paint the broad brush, but there is a substantial number of gamers, which is a very large group of people that are of that same, we were talking earlier about that right-wing mindset of only caring about something that happens to you. And the direct thing that they can draw the line to is, I got to pay for in-game content that directly affects me. The labor issues, which also directly affects them, but, you know, is a few steps away from that directness, I guess, unless you work for a gaming company yourself. I think that's where there's that that disconnect for them.
Right.
Oh, yeah. I think a lot of people think it's a dream job to work for a video game company. And so it's the one of those jobs where people just don't really consider it to be work unless they're doing it or they're adjacent to it. So they go like, how dare you complain about what they think is essentially playing Grand Theft Auto 6 all day for work. And it's like, that's not what game programmers do. So there's just not a lot of sympathy for people, I think, who work in the industry, from people who, like, you know, play games that come out of the industry.
Yeah.
I've never seen, I don't think there's any, like, I don't know how else to call them, any group of consumers of a specific type of medium or media that hates the people who create what they consume more than gamers. It's so bizarre to me. Like, music fans don't hate musicians and artists. Aficionados don't hate filmmakers. They may have strong opinions, but I've never seen like the hatred that like gamers have for the people who make the games they play in any other medium. It's so bizarre.
Yeah, I think the only thing you can compare it to is like how like parents hate teachers. Like you're so dependent, like you're so dependent on them. But because of like that, you have become very easily propagandized to look at them as your enemy by people who want to exploit them.
Yeah. Robin Reno, not ranchers, ranches, the brothels. Sorry, I'm not hip to that. I'm not hip to that lingo. When I see ranches, I think ranchers. I don't think of brothels. Not surprising on that regard either.
Speaking of Grand Theft Auto 6, real quick, United States Army is offering a 4-day pass to soldiers to play Grand Theft Auto 6 if they reenlist for 2 to 6 years.
Oh, yeah, I saw that.
Yeah.
And you know what? They're not even paying for the game. You just get time off. Like, you just literally get the time off.
4 days for at least another, you said 2 years.
Minimum
at least
two to 6 years.
Yeah.
Wait, so I mean, it's R&R specific to playing Grand Theft Auto 6?
Yeah.
Yes. What if you just want the time off?
You have to.
Maybe they're gonna log in and check your GTA 6 hours.
You better finish some missions.
I guess that's a good deal if you were planning on reenlisting anyway, and you get like the 4-day freebie that you wouldn't have gotten otherwise. But I hope no one's reenlisting just for the 4 days.
As a veteran of the Army, I met a few people who would buy that deal.
Oh my god,
man! I mean, well. Shit, do we still have the Shane and thing?
Yeah.
Yeah, let's go back to that, because this is that's actually a great transition in this long segment. But they do start talking about the military. So just go back like 5 seconds, and they get to one of the contradictions in our society is everyone knows that we shouldn't make it cost prohibitive to pay for health care. But yet we do. And I don't know why we lost Brandon in that shot there, but maybe we can look at that after we play Shane and this clip here.
I don't know anything.
that is a funny one to be like, fuck that. It's like, okay, well, sounds nice.
Yeah, the people holding it down for the insurance companies.
Yeah. Although my theory Sick. Is our military, we need to have kind of like a Dragon's Den situation, because if everyone had free healthcare, free college, you're not going to be able to get some young boy into the fucking military. He's going to go, bro, I'm chilling.
Yeah, Soviets did pretty good with it.
Oh, yeah, true.
They got several million. China has... They're doing all right.
Yeah, you're true.
The rest
you're
of the country has it.
Well, aren't they forced, though? They're forced. Okay, that should be the thing. We have free healthcare for anyone who will volunteer. Fuck, that's just the military, damn it. Why is this so hard?
I think...
after they fully block off porn sites, I think they can go, we'll let you in. You just have to do 18 months and one deployment.
You're saying you get Pornhub back?
You get Pornhub back if you join the military.
That's going to be tough. You got to do that fucking op school course.
All right, that's good. I actually do agree that it was better when, and actually probably led to more criticism of Empire, when the military service was compulsory. And it should be compulsory for all levels of society. And maybe that then people would learn that we shouldn't be doing this. We shouldn't be trying to solve every problem by deploying an aircraft carrier and lobbing missiles at countries that won't behave properly.
To contradict that, that would be the inevitable outcome. I present to you the IDF, right? I
don't think like that's the problem with that society. And I've even read the problem is the settler colonial context of
right.
of Israel, and that they're conquering their neighbors.
I guess that does guide it more. True.
Yeah, like I think there are plenty of countries that and also our service needs to be geared away from military aims toward things like the Civilians Conservation Corps, and actually I mean Climate Corps, that sort of thing. Like this is the compulsory service shouldn't be about, as Kamala Harris says, creating the most lethal fighting force in the entire world. That stuff needs to be completely like left in like 2024. We should have compulsory service, I think, that draws young people. We can have compulsory service that draws young people, because I think it actually is good to bring people all around to meet people from different parts of the country and work on a common goal. That common goal, again, should not be in conquering other countries. But I generally think like the we have compulsory, like you are compelled to work for capitalists. I am okay with some kind of compulsory service. Maybe that's especially when the question is like, well, the conditions are of this conversation are that we need a military. Well, it's like, I don't think that should just be a volunteer service. If you're saying we need a military and we're not going to question that premise, then I think it should be I don't think it can be left to like a volunteer service where you're suppressing people and keeping them impoverished so they join.
I agree with the thought that should be the response to anyone who has that, like, we need to, you know, how else do we get people to join this thing that we need, the military?
Right.
But I disagree that it with the overall, I don't think we should have a compulsory service. But, you know, Brandon's back. Brandon, did you go run to enlist in the military hearing about that 4-day off for GTA or something?
No, I'm actually not a big Grand Theft Auto fan, and so that's not really my game of choice.
If it was a different game, though, you would have considered?
Yeah. If it was Dark Souls 4, I would maybe consider it. Elden Ring 2, Sekiro 2, Bloodborne 2. But in GTA 6, first of all, 4 days is not even enough time to play it, essentially. like GTA 6 is going to be huge. It's going to take months to get through it all. So like 4 days is like a sucker's offer. Yeah, and they don't even pay for the game.
They don't even what? Oh, pay for the game. Yeah, they don't even provide it. I thought this was like a no. Early access.
Nope.
People are not
that would
happy.
Be crazy if Rockstar Games was working with the military to provide them soldiers with early access if they re-enlist. That would be a huge story. I think that would be a real issue.
People are not happy with my compulsory service take. Look, I just think that going from a draft to volunteer service, I think it has some bad side effects that we should maybe think about, but. I'm not completely firm on it. So if you have an issue with it, fine. I saw I am from somebody who worked at Rockstar. Rockstar Games laid me off days before my daughter was born. So fuck them. Steal whatever you want from those inhuman corporate pricks. Yeah. That's something I've heard of. I mean, I've never heard somebody say like, I love working at Rockstar. They treat their employees really well. So, yeah,
I feel like we just discovered who CyberLeak is and they're in our chat.
I mean, that would be, again, like you leave the crypto thing out of it and I really have nothing really bothers me about it.
Honestly, if I see a leak, I think Pete Hegseth. I think that this is like another Pete Hegseth leak, you know, probably somehow involved with the 4 days off from the military. He wants people to get all hyped up. It's, you know, enlist in the military, take the deal to re-enlist, something like that. But when I see a leak, my first mind goes to Pete Hegseth. Obviously, my second mind goes to Cash Patel. But generally speaking, I think of Trump administration figures. So I think we've got to start looking in the White House for this new rock star leak.
Brandon, somebody said you took a shot at North Dakota on your stream this morning. Is that
I didn't take a shot at North Dakota. I forgot which one you were from. And then we watched a video about how like a drought there has deeply impacted the corn and other like, you know, row crop industries.
Yeah, it's been very warm up there. Let's do Bill Gates. Not really speaking of North Dakota. Doug Burgum.
Someone sounds like Epstein.
I can't get over like Doug Burgum again, like Trump's what is he, Minister of Interior or Secretary of Interior, Minister, it's somewhere on the UK. Again, like he's a billionaire because Bill Gates gave him a lot of money for a company. Some people have said like this sort of the software that he did was really impressive, whatever. I'm not that interested in that. Here is Bill Gates, though. Bill Gates was on with Anderson Cooper. Very stark lighting on Anderson Cooper there. Talking to Bill Gates about AI and something that he is massively invested in with the amount of riches that he's been given through being a monopolist through all these years. Here is Bill Gates talking about AI.
Yes, it's across every sector of the economy, initially with white collar, but then as the humanoid robots come along, blue collar as well, you will have, for the first time, the equivalent of human cognition. So that past history misleads people because there we were richer, and so jobs like, you know, designing rides at Disneyland, having more psychiatrists, we were richer enough to create those additional jobs. Here, as the machine gets better than human for well-defined jobs and works 24 hours a day, it's going to be a bigger deal. And so the bar for somebody coming along and saying this time is different is very high. But I'm staking my reputation completely on the fact that in terms of the impact on the job market, this is very different than any technology that I've been involved in or that has come across in human history. I divide the challenge here into two periods. We have the next 20 years where the AIs are not able to, you know, make all the food and do the manufacturing and, you know, maintain all the robots. And so you'll have, once you get to that 20-year period, you'll have deep purpose issues, but you'll have a lot of abundance. I'm more focused in this memo on how do we get through this incredibly turmoil-ridden period we'll have, where society's adjusting to this completely unprecedented set of capabilities. And, you know, I'm saying, don't think that they're going to stop and not be good at things. There's people who, you know, think, oh, they must, you're going to reach some upper mm-hmm. bound. For the majority of jobs, that is not the case. And so the silence is what really drove me to speak out at this point, because we have to get everybody's voice in this. You know, these are.
I want to make sure I heard him correctly there about what he said about the upper bound, because I found this very. Let's just let him go into it.
Don't think that they're going to stop and not be good at things. There's people who, you know, think, oh, they must. You're going to reach some upper bound. For the majority of jobs, that is not the case. And so the silence is what really drove me to speak out at this point, because we have to get everybody's voice in this. You know, these are a set of democratic trade-offs that have to be made. And, you know, people who think, okay, I'll block a data center, that really isn't going to slow things down. Those data centers will show up somewhere. We have to take the AI issue and it's the bads versus the goods on in a very explicit way.
All right, you guys respond to that first. I got something to say though.
Yeah, sure. So I read he's probably on Anderson Cooper because he recently published a 6,000 word essay on how we should deal with AI, and half of it is the same sort of bravado we hear from the AI industry about how, you know, it's gonna do all these amazing things and replace everything because there's no stopping what's coming, and you know what he was saying right there. And then another half were some ideas on how to deal with it. He floated a AI tax where the he basically said that companies have to pay a payroll tax when they hire a human. Companies should have to pay a tax if they, you know, replace those humans with AI, and that could fund retraining and the social safety net programs. And he floated an idea of human reserved jobs where there are some jobs that absolutely need a human touch no matter how good AI gets. He actually went with caregiver, and he gave the specific example that he knew that his father was in good hands when his father was on his deathbed a few years ago. You know, again, you have to have that experience in a lot of these guys' minds to truly get what's
right,
going
exactly.
on.
Exactly.
It happens every time.
Anecdote.
Yeah.
And not
yeah,
what you, science couldn't tell you this bill.
Right. But I mean, you know, it's this. He's. I think this is disingenuous. I think the ideas he floated weren't bad, especially coming from someone like him. But the presentation of AI continues to be the same from all of these guys. He's just doing it in a way of, oh, I'm concerned, instead of, oh, this is coming and we're going to make a lot of money, so either jump on board or get left behind. You know, the idea that that AI won't hit a peak or plateau, or at least not like continue to have like a hockey stick style growth in terms of how good it gets, is ludicrous. Like there is a point where this will flatten out. It's not going to continue to like, it's that meme that you've probably seen where the guy holds up his baby and it's like, oh, after a year, my baby is now like 50% bigger than he was a year ago. Yeah. You know, that means in 10 years, he's going to weigh, 2,000 pounds and be 9 feet tall. Like, that's just not how things work. Things ebb and flow. There'll be ways that this doesn't, it hits a peak and it doesn't advance anymore, or it slows down its advancement, or maybe even goes backwards in ways. We've already seen that, because we know that once AI data trains on other AI data, it actually puts out worse content, worse output, because it just can't do that. It needs this a source of human data, human created data, to learn and train off of. And the way these guys push it, where humans won't be doing any of this stuff anymore, then yeah, we will see a point, sorry, Bill Gates, where this stuff just gets exponentially worse. I mean, it's not even that great to begin with, where we're at this point of even talking about it this way.
No, I think that's right. What I got from that whole thing was Bill Gates finding new ways to say, look, AI is not good enough to do any of the stuff that we've promised yet. It's also no longer at the point where we can subsidize all of the costs ourselves. And you're starting to notice the cost of using these tokens go up. And it's also very, very unpopular. But we need you. The tech industry needs you to weather the storm. Bosses, once we're done getting all this training, you might not be able to replace all your workers yet, but one day you might be able to replace all your workers. So stick with us. Stick with us. Keep paying these increasing token costs. Keep with us. You know, people out there, you can't stop us. One day we'll be delivering a post-abundant society. You may not like data centers, but don't fight them because they're coming somewhere at some point. And of course, the government, you know, you want to be with us. But really, to me, it just seems like they need to tell you anything to keep you from disconnecting from AI because it's just not that useful right now. And 20 years from now, how many more billions of dollars will they have burned to make something that like one day will be useful? Maybe what he's trying to sell, I think, is something that is, you know, just not realistic. And people are starting to realize that. And he's going out there because he has still some clout left, despite the Epstein stuff, because he's Bill Gates. He's going out there to try to sell you a hope and a prayer because the tech industry has nothing else. They have nothing else but this AI stuff. No one's going to buy those stupid Meta glasses because they're pervert glasses. And so if AI crumbles, a lot of companies and people are overinvested in it, and it'll bring down the entire tech industry. And so he wants everyone to just take it on the chin while the AI companies figure it out. While they just figure out how to make the thing that eventually puts everyone out of work and delivers us to a post-scarcity society. But they're not actually even really, I don't know, close to that. 20 years, I think, is a pipe dream. But that's all that sounds like to me. Like, you've realized now that it's not useful for anything, really, except for kind of like widgets and bobbits that won't make you enough money. But just stick with us.
I also think they live in a bubble in terms of what jobs these are affecting. Like, when AI, when like ChatGPT and a lot of these things first went live and got big and went mainstream, the big push was writing. You know, it'll replace writers, it'll replace content creators. And then they moved into image and video generation, that, oh, it's going to replace graphic designers and filmmakers. And that continues to be the push from the tech industry, that this is like great stuff. You see it all the time online. People are like, oh, Hollywood's afraid. And then they throw out, look what I can do.
Yeah.
And they throw out like a 5 minute, the worst 5 minutes of any sort of content you've ever seen. It's horrible. And people most people who consume this stuff are actually feel the same way as the creator, as actual creators, that this stuff is just not good. It's where the term AI slop has come from, but that's like very obviously bad, and visually it's bad, so it hasn't replaced those jobs. But one area where it turned out AI is really good at, in terms of at least the facade of being able to replace people, is in software development, in coding apps and doing coding stuff. Like, that's why Anthropic is growing at such a bigger rate, or got much more popular with Claude than or is at least encroaching on OpenAI's hold over the AI industry, because they were the ones that focused on the coding aspect that Claude can do. And a lot of software engineers and coders and programmers bought into that, and they use it. And it actually turns out that that's where AI is pretty good. So the tech industry is worried that, oh, it's starting to replace jobs. You know, it's not. If you actually use this stuff, it clearly isn't as good as a human coder. It actually does create the AI slap equivalent of code, but that's not a visual. That's not visual, right? Like, if it make sloppy code, but on the front end people are able to use that stuff, people really don't see how bad the back end of the code is. So it's not as automatic of a turnoff as like the video and image generation stuff is. So, you know, that's where I think the disconnect is. They see that this stuff is actually good or passable in replacing things in their industry, and they think it's the same for others, and that's exactly just not the case.
But this I would even say that it's not so good at replacing coding that like large tech firms have been able to fully replace the amount of coders that they would need to be to make it viable. This is the kind of like AI is the kind of dream thing for like a startup that instead of hiring like a, you know, 10 coder team, instead wants to hire 4 coders and work them to death. Because if you're a big enough company, like that's where we're seeing a lot of the rolling back. It just becomes a waste of money. You know, ultimately, unless you have some reason to integrate AI, like the cost of this, these AI models usage is just cheaper to pay someone right now. And I think that's what like a lot of the Bill Gates stuff is coming from, where people still just see reasonably it's cheaper to pay people in different countries to do it than it is to pay these token costs. It's actually just cheaper to get a coding team out in Eastern Europe or in Africa or in like, you know, India. And, you know, if nothing else, like have them look over the code that AI produces. And if you're going to do that anyway, they might as well just code it. Like, and I just think that that's not going to change fast enough for it to be profitable at the level that like these AI firms want it to be in order for like them to be able to stay afloat for long enough for the tech industry to not suffer from the collapse. Because it doesn't, you know, to your point, I think it does cause them to overestimate it, but it doesn't just need to replace coders for it to be as valuable as they want it to be. It has to replace all of us. And that has just always been like a pipe dream. And, you know, but that's part of the ever moving, the ever increasing need for capital and accumulation that like the tech industry has now. Like they just can't, you know, they can't imagine a ceiling.
Yeah, also, they've rolled a lot of stuff that already existed, like a lot of like automation software and automation processes that existed well before ChatGPT and all these other AI products went live. They rolled all that into this industry as a whole. Like you were able to like automate processes on your computer using like both local and like software as a service platforms well before AI was a thing. Yes. But all of a sudden now they got to prop up the AI industry. So all that automation stuff is all of a sudden the same AI as ChatGPT and Claude. And then you see, for example, a lot of like machine learning stuff that was used in video cameras so that content creators could actually go out and focus on the content itself and not worry about like, you know, I guess certain things like focus and visual quality and things like that. So they could actually focus on the content itself. That stuff existed well before ChatGPT and Claude and Grok and all this stuff, but that's all been rolled into this. Yep. And, you know, face tracking for like sports cameras existed before this, but that's been rolled into the AI industry. Like this is all the AI industry, LLMs, OpenAI, Anthropic, all these companies, they've enveloped over so many different areas in order to prop up the industry. And it's unfortunate because a lot of cool and good things will probably get hurt when this whole thing goes bust as well.
I mean, we have a few IMs here that I'll read. Some guide, they're selling a fancy if-then function as a computer god. Science is political. AI is currently just a new form of Google searching, but a Google search is only as good as the questions asked, and too many people never check the sourcing. And then ethical AI. Do you guys even know what an open model is? I think is what you meant to ask there. The reality is that millions of Americans use AI and will not stop. You could be spending the time encouraging people to open source options, but instead you engaged in cope and being Luddites. AI is already useful. It's not the fraud you guys think it is. Now, I think this is a common mistake, I think. So like Binder said, I've been using text-to-speech software way before I even heard AI. Well, I guess I read the Nick Bostrom book back in like 2011 or whatever it came out. But and I never thought about that as AI, that generative speech was AI. And now like all the companies that do offer that service, which I do find useful, and I think like maybe like people with sight issues would also find useful, they call themselves AI. And so, like, I did an interview with Robbie Martin on Left Reckoning years ago, who uses the image stuff in it to create, like, unsettling stuff. I've never said this stuff is completely devoid of utility. What we are saying is that it is not anywhere close to going to return the amount that this society has invested in it in this period. It is an absolute bubble, 100%. And what he said about people think it's just going to level off and never... you know, and just go exponential. Well, a lot of it, it's true that, like, there's only so many ways you can summarize a PDF. You can't summarize it a million times better than a human could. That's just not a possible thing to do with a PDF. And I'll also read a couple headlines here from Financial Times, August 6th of this month. At least half a dozen senior National Health Service leaders linked to Palantir. Extent of ties revealed as scrutiny grows of U.S. tech company's contract to build new data platform. Later that same week, August 10th, UK cost estimate of Palantir NHS data platform rises to more than $1 billion. The subhead, lifetime change charge rises to $1.1 billion on increased delivery at scale, while forecast benefits fall to $808 million. So the cost is $1 billion, and the projected forecasts are $808 million. That is what we are talking about, is that it actually can't deliver what they say it can deliver. There's a usefulness to having chatbots. There's a usefulness to this sort of stuff. This is basically a continuation of the machine age. Like, there's a usefulness to be able to use AutoCAD to create blueprints for buildings instead of doing it by hand, right? The computers are, surprise, useful. They were also useful when the dot-com bubble went bust. Because, again, our society that's built on creating value for investors put too much investment into that certain area. That's definitely what's going to happen with AI too. And so these sort of maximalist ways of looking at this, that Bill Gates selling it as if it's just going to take off. It's going to have abundance, and then we're at a crisis. How about you deliver the abundance first? Because I think the actual crisis is not a crisis. The real crisis, if that were the case, is that capitalism rules by a dictate: work or starve. This is the exact same conversation we had with Shane Gillis and Matt, where they're talking about, if we give everyone healthcare, how are we going to get people to join the military? This is the compulsion we're talking about. And we have seen massive improvements to productivity. This is, our grandparents would have been preoccupied with the machine age the way that we are preoccupied with this. And the truth is that, yes, even the internet, like copy paste. That is now you can, instead of pressing all this music into a vinyl or into a cassette, now you can just copy and paste it. That does have big impacts on industries, no doubt. But that it's going to lead to a Jetson-style future just around the corner if we just keep abiding by these guys. And he says, like, you know, stopping a data center won't fix all this. No. Overthrowing people like Bill Gates from running our society is what we actually need to do. Stopping a data center is just a small step in that sort of direction.
Well, so they're not worried about you stopping a data center. I don't really know how to respond to that comment, because no one said AI wasn't useful. They said it wasn't going to generate the kind of revenue necessary to prop up the industry. So I'm just going to say they're not worried about you stopping data center. Like he said, they're worried about you making it more expensive, because they're industry is hemorrhaging money.
Yep.
He wants everyone to just roll over, because any effort you put in to stop them just makes the already inefficient and not money earning or money generating or such a profit generating industry that they have more expensive to run. And it's right before a lot of these companies are going to do their IPOs. It's before the midterm, so a lot of politicians might actually decide to take a stand on data centers, at least rhetorically, which will make the IPOs less successful. They're just very, very much aware that they're in the middle of a bubble, and they want to get as integrated into our system as possible, like how Grok is with apparently like the Pentagon or whatever, so that like by the time the bubble collapses, they get a golden parachute from our tax dollars. So all of that open source stuff is irrelevant, because these companies are looking for a golden parachute once their industry collapses with our tax dollars. That's just it. They're waiting
Absolutely.
For that.
And yes. And I think the concern that I have is that golden parachute will be in the form of massive government giveaways to them so that they can use all this hardware to basically just process surveillance information.
I think both of those are great points. I mean, it's not about the individual data centers itself. More broadly speaking, it's exactly what Brandon just said, but even more direct in terms of what the data center sentiment is around the country is a uprising against AI, which they thought people were going to absolutely eat from their hands. Like, they thought there was they thought they had a killer product. Each of these companies thought they had a killer product on their hands that was going to be immediately used, and all sorts of companies from and personal use would automatically adopt these products, and it would be ubiquitous in people's homes. And they were not prepared for there to not only just be critics, but for it to be a widespread pushback against the entire technology as a whole. But that's what happens when your whole point for selling this is that this product is going to completely make your job redundant. You are absolutely, right. If we succeed. And then they want people to support that. It's
well, that's the thing is like they aren't. That's why like tech enthusiasts that want you to be more friendly about AI. This isn't about enthusiasts. They aren't talking. They aren't leading with the pitch of this is going to take all jobs because they want to alienate people. That's just a byproduct. The reason they talk about that is because that's what investors want to hear. Yeah. They want to hear that you can buy into the company that is going to put everyone out of work, AKA do all the labor and basically capitalize on throwing all those people out of work. That's why they sell this. And it's politically self-defeating. Now we got a clip here and we can talk about this a little bit more, but this is on the subject. Decoding Fox News has this clip here with Laura Ingraham. This and, is 10, right?
Yeah. Lydia Moynihan, the financial correspondent for the New York Post. We've watched
her. Her Wikipedia in a second here. It says there is data center derangement syndrome. Ooh, a new derangement syndrome is out. That is fascinating. I wonder if you get diarrhea from it. Here is the New York Post lady and Laura Ingraham.
It's a sort of data center derangement syndrome. There's a mass hysteria both on the right and the left with people pushing back against this. And a lot of it is premised, understandably, people don't want this in their backyard. But consider the fact that only 50% of people are opposed to a nuclear power plant in their community. Almost 75% of people are opposed to data centers. And some of this is because of misinformation. There's been a lot of studies super off base. For instance, you mentioned water as a concern. People are worried it's using too much water. Golf courses use 20 to 30 times more water. And you have to think about...
Now, I have come out as anti-golf course before, but I think maybe, again, I'll walk that back and say they should just be more democratized, shall we say. I do think it's a pretty crazy when you look at most municipalities in this country, and instead of parks, they have private golf courses. That kind of, I kind of don't like that. But anyway, like this sort of thing... We all benefit theoretically from golf courses. The AI, the benefits to AI are not broadly shared. That's kind of, or they're not even as broadly shared as the benefits of golf courses. I think it's maybe a better way.
Or even a nuclear power plant.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, right. Like, and that's when someone says like, well, this person took, money from a solar company or whatever. Like, that's just like APAC. It's like, no, it's not. But let's play the clip a little bit more before we react to it.
Courses use 20 to 30 times more water. And you have to think about, yes, obviously there's a natural cause, but who stands to benefit if the U.S. really tries to have data center construction? Bingo. So you have to ask, where is this coming from, right? And it's being amplified by the Chinese. Neville Roy Singham, who I know you've covered on this show, who's a big backer of Code Pink, he's also behind some of these efforts. He's, as a result of his NGOs and his nonprofits, has halted about $23 billion worth of data centers in America. So, look, China is eager for us to halt data centers, and that's why I think you're seeing a lot of this really moving at a rapid clip.
Now, we're seeing Greg Abbott put together a whole list of restrictions and regulations and hurdles they'll have to clear. He's a pretty big free market guy, but he's also hearing from his, his residents and the voters in his state who are, again, I think a lot of people are, they're very worked up about this. But in New York, Kathy Hochul created the nation's first ban on a large scale of these data centers. Another thing you hear is that once the centers are constructed, then in many ways they'll kind of power themselves as time goes on. You really won't need any workers at these centers, so there'll be these giant fields of you know, whirring compute systems, and they're not going to be great job creators. What about that?
Yeah, and the size of Manhattan. Actually, President Trump addressed this briefly yesterday, saying if he was a governor, he would want these in his community. Because if you look at the outcome of a data center being built, a lot of these are beginning to offer sort of data center dividends.
Like pollution? Is that what they call like pollution? Data center dividends? Well, I'm not pro golf course either. And I think that they have to like reference that even is a sign that they're losing, because most people don't use golf courses. I've heard people reference like the amount of water houses use. I think that's a little bit more relatable. But golf courses, I think, are just meant to appeal to the other types of business owners who also don't benefit from this kind of thing. Like farmers don't like this. AI data centers just don't benefit large enough swaths of the population for it to be like worthwhile for anybody to like overlook how it's going to impact them. It's the kind of bad technology that tech companies are obsessed with now in the aftermath of the internet and like personal computers and smartphones and social media. Every product that comes out now is aiming for like mass spontaneous adoption. Like for this product to be successful, basically everyone has to buy it and use it religiously immediately, the same way they do their smartphones. And they don't have any patience for actually like building ultimately any of that stuff besides the data centers in terms of like actually developing it over time. They just need it to come out and everyone has to use it immediately.
Yeah, absolutely. The Elon Musk in his lunatic ramblings with The Economist magazine, which I cover on Left Reckoning a few weeks back, he said one thing I do agree with, which is that we'll probably lose that race to China. And I think we need to ask ourselves what happens if that's the case? If we completely like let these tech people roll over our communities and put these noisy, polluting data centers in, and then it turns out China finds a way, like they have been doing, of approximating the utility at a fraction of the cost, both in terms of dollars and energy, because they're doing it under restrictions that say they can't buy the chips that are made right off their coast in Taiwan. They're doing it. They're learning how to be more efficient at it. And what happens if they all of a sudden, like if you're a smaller nation and you want an AI solution for something, let's just act as if this is going to be real, or to the extent it is real. Are you going to go to the very expensive folks in America, or are you going to go to the more affordable models that China can offer? And I would say, I think maybe we should be investing, not putting all our eggs in the AI basket like these people want us to. And maybe we should look into how we can build an economy for the future, like for things we need, like China is doing, in addition to also basically following us neck and neck with the AI thing. This is a pathetic place for America to be in right now, to be waiting for pie in the sky from San Francisco perverts that said like our AI God is going to give you abundance if you just give us a couple more quarters and fund us and let us do contracts and let Trump say I would love to have one in Fort Lauderdale. Well, put it there.
Yeah, no windmills, which he really means wind turbines, obviously, but we should have a data center there. I mean, it's all very embarrassing because China certainly hasn't like propped up its entire economy on the promise of AI. Even if they are going to beat us in this race, they've been investing in it more efficiently. So they're not worried that like three companies that are passing $1 back and forth a trillion times might collapse and bring down the entire American economy.
100%.
I mean, we've received a sneak peek of what the U.S. Trump's administration plans to do to deal with China beating the U.S. in different areas of technology. We see it with the drone ban. The Trump administration has banned any imported drones from China. And as a result, some of the biggest drone makers, and I'm talking about consumer level drone makers like DJI, have been banned from shipping their newest products to the US. And because they're banned from doing that, it's not just drones that are affected, it's all their products. So give you an example, DJI just came out with their latest gimbal camera, and they can't ship it to the US. They can't sell it in the US because of the ban that the Trump administration has on the company in general because of their drone products. What's basically happening is U.S. Creators who want this camera, they have to import it into the country through third parties who aren't supposed to be importing it into the country, and they have to do it for exorbitant prices because there really isn't any U.S. maker of any of DJI's products that comes close to what they make. And so what you have is a situation where the Trump administration is hoping some U.S. companies step in, obviously, but there aren't any. It's something that if they were a U.S. company, they were already buying it or manufacturing it in China to begin with, so they can't import it into the country either.
Yeah. Eclectic Llama says, here's what I don't get. What does it mean if we let China win the AI race? Win what? This argument is predicated on an endgame of artificial general intelligence. It's a bad argument because AGI is a pipe dream. I agree with that. This isn't a space race with a determinative end goal. What this is really about is China catching up to us, not just on producing cars, but also in terms of computation. And they are, and they're going to. And that is one of the last advantages American capitalists have. And if they lose it, it's kind of the ball game. There's another Financial Times thing from last February where Xi Jinping did a photo op with the sort of creators of DeepSeek AI, the Chinese model that sort of spooked a lot of our folks. And this is quite a difference than the way we treat our AI people. He said, the meeting on Monday was Xi's first high-profile encounter with private entrepreneurs in several years. He took pains to emphasize the entrepreneurs' importance to China's economic strength, referring to the, quote, two unshakable principles, end quote, meaning that both the public and private sector should be supported. He also reiterated the ruling Chinese Communist Party's control over business, stressing that companies should be ambitious in serving the country. We do not have the same type of capitalism here. If you want to call it capitalism, it is different than how we're doing it, which is to invite Elon Musk in for 90 minutes to talk to The Economist about how he's going to hand his company over to the computer god in 10 years. And y'all don't need to worry about what that means for the economy, because all the AI guys will get together and figure out how to do a basic income for y'all. Like, we have lost our minds on this issue. By following these sort of charlatans through this rabbit hole of boosterism for their products that they are taking investment on. And meanwhile, they're saying it's going to create the end of the world. The world might be ending, but it might be ending for them.
Well, yeah, no, I think the economy is going to collapse before the world ends. But for a lot of members of our government, that's going to be like the same thing, because they imagine they're going to have to at least partially answer to the American people about how these bubbles got so big for so long. Because we're experiencing, I think, like multiple overlapping bubbles. The real estate market is terrible. The commercial real estate market is terrible. And now like this AI thing, it's possible that just multiple sectors of American, you know, industry will just collapse overnight. I'm sure you've seen the functional unemployment rate, the way it is. Like, you know, America is literally on a knife's edge when it comes to the economy. And, you know, all we can do is keep pumping more smoke into the AI industry. But Trump alienating other countries certainly isn't going to help keep that afloat.
Yeah, you don't think telling Canada that they shouldn't have any relationship with China because Xi Jinping's going to come and take their hockey sticks? You don't think that's like the kind of sensible leadership we need in this moment?
Let's do 10 years from now, they'll be winning hockey.
They'll be what?
They'll be winning hockey. The Chinese. China. They'll be ruling the ice. Mighty Ducks 3, Beijing, Beijing Bonanza, whatever they want to call it. I guess there's already a Mighty Ducks 3. So I guess, you know, 4.
Only you would know there's actually a Mighty Ducks 3, I think. Maybe Binder, are you aware there's a Mighty Ducks
3? I said this.
I wasn't.
I honestly didn't know there was multiple Jurassic Parks, so maybe I'm not the person to ask on this.
I mean, I guess with the Mighty Ducks movies, it makes sense because that's one of those franchises that went deep into the whatever the equivalent of like the made for DVD movies are, where like Land Before Time, for example, has like 20 different movies after the first one because they were all directly released to VHS and you have no idea that they exist. It's one of those.
Well, I've seen a lot of those actually. I know a lot about the Mighty the Mighty Ducks also had a cartoon show that was on Disney Channel for a while too. So see, three movies and a cartoon show, but there are, I've watched a ton of the Land Before Time movies, like Chomper, you know. You don't remember Chomper?
I just know the first one, which is an absolute classic. Yeah. I know the others exist. I just don't think they it's one of those movies where it should have stayed with the first one and didn't need to go any further in that universe.
We have a lot of response on this, but I think we do need to move on to one final clip here. Dana Nessel, who is on the David Frum show. Wow. This Democrat. Dana Nessel, who inappropriately used her office to go after students for protesting the Israeli assault on Gaza. She's on the David Frum show, a war criminal, the coiner. If people don't know who David Frum is, he's the coiner of the term Axis of Evil under the Bush administration. I don't know if he was a spokesperson or just a speechwriter, but he's been a long time, war pig. Let's hear what he and Dana Nessel.
Branding expert. Branding expert.
Sure. I've said this over and over again, that, you know, when a black person says that phrase that you're using or the way you're talking about this issue to me is racist, I'd like you to stop doing it. We respect that. When somebody, when we're talking to somebody in the LGBTQ community and say, I don't like the phrase that you're using, or that term is offensive to me, and here's why, we respect that in the Democratic Party. We say, okay, I'm not going to use that phrase anymore. I didn't realize that it was offensive to you. I'm going to stop. But this has been an outlier for me. I have people saying, you are not going to tell us what you deem to be anti-Semitic. We'll decide what's anti-Semitic.
Hold on. The fact that she said this over and over again is especially concerning, because in what world is she living in where people have universally determined to not say racist things to black people and homophobic or transphobic things to the LGBTQ plus community? What world is she living in? Literally, we see on a daily basis people within her own party, if she wants to try to claim it's just her own party that she's talking about, throw trans people under the bus over and over again to things that they have argued are hurtful to them. Just look at what the whole talk about trans people in sports when we're talking about literal children, because there are no professional trans athletes. I mean,
also,
what world is she living in where we've universally determined and everyone respects on top of that? Everyone respects it, too. This is ludicrous.
Also, don't you remember when Joe Biden said, if you don't vote for him, you're not black? another great line. No, I mean, this is just neoliberal identity politics. Because they control the platforms, they get to platform certain members of each individual subpopulation that they want you to listen to. And then they demand that if you don't listen to this one person, then you're not actually listening to that group of people. It's like the most obvious trick in their book, the Hillary Clinton thing. But of course, because they control the platforms, they just control who you get to see. And so it just becomes like, well, if you won't listen to James Clyburn, you don't know black people. If you won't listen to Hillary Clinton, you hate women. It's, I mean, people are hip to it now. If anyone watches the David Frum show.
It's interesting, though, that she left out a group that would be, I guess, most analogous. And that would be Muslims and Arab people and Middle Eastern people. Yep. I mean, interesting, because we all know that.
You don't take their word for it.
Yeah, we don't care about what they have to say. In fact, we do the opposite of whatever they deem to be hurtful. I mean, it is incredible.
The comparison is just so ridiculous. Like, what atrocities are the LGBTQ community committing? And then people are saying, hey, don't criticize us. You're being anti-gay. Like, Dana Nessel, like, this is not about anti-Semitism. Dana Nessel, let's finish her. But this is about Support of Israel, Dana. This is not about your ethnicity. This is about whether it's you or Hakeem Jeffries. It's your support for a country that is committing atrocities with U.S. taxpayer dollars. And not just that, but also corrupting our civil society to force lies about that, to be respected as truths, and truths to be denounced as hateful lies. It is appalling. It is more appalling than anything I'd ever thought I'd witness when I got into this business, frankly. Is the perversion of our democracy by folks who are mainly concerned with an ethno state across the world. But here, let's let her finish because I'm sure she's got more. Maybe she'll bring it home.
Tell us what you deem to be anti-Semitic. We'll decide what's anti-Semitic. That's not up for you, the Jewish population, to decide. And I find that to be very off-putting and offensive. And you know, I'd
be offended.
I think that's totally unacceptable. But the last thing I will say is this. If that's the deal that has to be made, and I've been really candid about this, I was Jewish before I was ever Michigan Attorney General. I'm going to be Jewish afterwards. I was Jewish before I was ever a member of the Democratic Party. And if I have to, I'll be Jewish afterwards, too.
Attorney General Nessel, thank you so much for joining me today.
Jewish exit. Dave Rubin was talking about it. It's Jexit. It's Jexit, folks. And guess what? Zohra Mamdani is approval rating. I don't know if we have that clip still handy, but there's this very cute clip of him being asked, like, hey, you're like massively popular with Jewish New Yorkers. How does that make you feel? And he absolutely glows. This is a time for choosing on this issue for Jewish people. And I understand that's very difficult. But there is a clear choice, and you can decide whether you're not no longer a Democrat like A.G. Nessel is. And I do think that the tent is too big if it involves people that are willing to lie and use their office of attorney general for a state to inappropriately go after students who are protesting what this country is supporting across the world. So, yeah, exit. Bye. Don't let the door hit you on the way out.
I would love if she gave an example of what she said, an example of something that she deems as anti-Semitic that people have told her isn't. Because I'm sure the second she gives an example of that, you know, most intellectual people are going to go, wait a minute, that's just criticism of Israel. That's not anything to do with Jewish people.
Exactly.
Well, I mean, that's what they're afraid of. They're afraid of losing control over the political identity of all these marginalized groups, because that's what the Democratic Party and a lot of these neoliberal establishments have going for them, that they get to go like, no, we are the group that represents Black people politically. We are the group that represent Jewish people politically. And if you go against the things that we're saying on these things, you're going against this large group of people. And you don't want that, because it acts as a cudgel against their own like liberal base, because they get very easily confused by what is no different than like Black cop discourse. It's like the Democratic version of Black cop discourse. Like, how can cops be racist if some of them are Black? Because a lot of them just believe that same notion about different institutions, because they believe it about the Democrats and like the Democratic Party, you know, stamp of approval institutions, but they might not believe about the Republican ones. But you know, Democrats are pro cop too a lot. So I guess it really is just a mixed bag. And so I do think that a lot of this is about Israel, but I think Israel in this case is a cipher for a lot of things. It's a cipher for our policy in the Middle East and Democrats wanting to have some vehicle to support the military industrial complex, but not have it blow back against them when like they're, you know, supposedly pro-peace, anti-war base gets mad at them. I think it's for a lot of Democrats a very scary idea that they might lose dominance of the narratives of these large groups of people when it comes to like voting. And so, I mean, I think that they've really been going hard against this because of how much is at stake when it comes to like people realizing that our entire political system just doesn't have, you know, the kind of support across the board that they need to in order to represent the people legitimately. And this issue with Israel is just so unpopular in both Republican and Democratic circles at this point, and they don't want anyone to notice it. They're using every tool that they can to prevent people from noticing it.
Yeah, and again, like, they are holding on for dear life because it's been blown. It's over. And so many nominally Jewish organizations should look at themselves very, very closely right now and realize, do I want to go down with that ship? And unfortunately, like, some will. But I think for majority of Jewish people that I know, and I think polling says this, Israel isn't really the entirety of their Jewish identity. And there is going to, and you're seeing this accelerate, the untangling, particularly in younger folks, that this is an anachronism. This is not something that we, it's an inheritance that the entire world has got from a very horrible time in the World War II and the Holocaust. But it has not been the right way to address anything remotely concerning hate. And nobody proposing that it is has any leg to stand on to tell you that actually you should be careful what road you're going down as far as hatred. You all just supported a genocide that you deny in front of our faces. You supported and deny it. You are genocide supporters and deniers at the exact same time. And you don't have credibility. So, yes, Dana Nessel, I have news for you. If you ever choose to see the light and become an anti-Zionist, you will still be Jewish, just like you were before you were one. That's actually, you can step away from the nationalism, and you need to. Or you should just be a fucking Republican. We didn't have time for calls today. Also, I'm not 100% sure that I know how to accept them, so that's kind of why.
Not so easy being Emma.
On that note, folks, I think I will be back in this chair tomorrow. Sam will be checking in, though, with a discussion with Digby about the week's news that he's going to record at some point before the show tomorrow. And we'll be back with another fun half and end the week. So with that, check. Well, I'm not going to do plugs again. See you, folks.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm going to get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the